story. And I'm really surprised, Andy, and I'm sure you're going to be talking about this once we start the chat. When I listened to you, and those of you who have listened to the show already, I was floored. I could not believe what I was listening to. As a matter of fact, I was out shopping, and I was listening to Alfred Weber, and then he had Andy on the show, and it was just a mind-boggling story. I mean, I thought, how is this not in the mainstream media? And, you know, I waited for a few months to make contact with Andy, and here we are. We did a show. He did a seven-hour show with Jessica Mystic. He's been with Red Eyes Creations. He's been with Project Camelot. And I think this story is just, if he hasn't exploded yet, it will be exploding soon. So I'm hoping that we can do our part. And by the way, Andy, Cliff High says hello.
I was very flattered to be named the first of the two major planetary whistleblowers that have been predicted by Alta. And I just want him and everybody else to know that I take my responsibilities in that area very seriously. And I'm going to be projecting the information that I have, hopefully, to every corner of the globe. I mean, we're going somewhere with this.
Absolutely. And obviously, you know who Cliff High is from the WebBot Project. He believes that this story is going to be big. Over.
I think that what's curious about that aspect of the story, sort of as a sidebar to the whole rollout of my information, both the Mars findings and the Pegasus revelations that I'm going to be making, is that the technique that he used pretty much focuses on the Mars material. But I think what's going to have the most transformative impact is going to be the way in which I'm going to be able to articulate the fact that the U.S. government developed a quantum access capability in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And I think that's going to have more power to transform the world for the better. So what's curious about his methodology is that it focuses on the Mars findings that I've thus far published. But I think the actual planetary whistleblower role that I'm going to be playing is in regard to DARPA's Project Pegasus and the fact that the U.S. government essentially achieved time travel 40 years ago and has been using it for a variety of purposes that have been kept secret. And so that's one thing I'd like to talk to Cliff about, because I think he used a very advanced methodology and arrived at data that actually indicates something else that's going to be occurring.
Absolutely. And his email today to me was very flattering, because he said to me, you know, I need to help you out. I need to make you more known. And coming from him, that's a compliment. You know, he's known now by so many people. And it was funny, our first interview together, he didn't know who I was. So, and people had taken his Alta report and plastered it everywhere, so it was not the best interview. But the second one he changed, and the third time, you know, we're friends. We talk, we don't talk that often, but we at least correspond with each other every week. And when the next Alta report comes out, he's always going to be coming to the show. And with you now, same thing, Andy. Your story, I know it's going to roll. So anyway, it's 9:01, and we're going to start introducing Andy formally. By the way, I want to say hello to the ones who are joining us. We have somebody from Mexico, Waycaster. Is that Mexico or Italy? I'm not. No, they have something in the middle of the flag, so I presume it's Mexico. And then Justina from Greece. By the way, thank you, Justina. Thanks to Justina for lending us her chat system. This is actually her company's chat system that she allows the Veritas community to use, because the one we used to have before was not private, but this one is very, very private, very, very advanced, and, you know, it's a great treat for us to be here. At any rate, 9:02 p.m., our time, different times around the world. I want to thank you for joining us, Andrew Basiago and I, for this special chat that I call the very first Veritas show live, which is a great benefit for our members. I don't need to introduce Andy. I don't need to read his bio. By now, those of you who are joining must have listened to the show or must know who Andy is. So I'm going to let Andy introduce himself one more time. And then here's just some ground rules for tonight. Because the chat system moves from down up, sometimes it's a little bit difficult to see the questions. And I want all of you to ask as many questions as possible, but I want to do this in a very in an orderly fashion. So what I'm going to do is, once we start with the question part, I'm going to stop the chat part. And then locate, if you could, on the right, where it says online, there's a drop-down arrow. Locate where it says question. Once I stop the chat system, I want you to click on the question mark, and I will be observing who asks first. And then I'll be choosing that person, and I will say it via the microphone. For example, if I take Malcram, for example, if I see that he clicked the question mark first, I'll tell him, Malcram, please ask your question, and we're going to let Malcram type. And I will ask all of you to refrain from typing so that the people who are asking, oh, thank you, Justina, so you're recording. That's perfect. So we can upload it and have it for those who are not able to listen. Are you saying, are you recording the text or are you recording the audio? Perfect. The other day I tried to record the text as well. Oh, by the way, I will also, when I see the question written, I'm also going to, Andy obviously is going to be able to read it, but I'm also going to ask the question so that we can have it on the audio. Okay? Fair to everybody? Everybody ready to go? Great. So let's have Andy introduce himself once again. Welcome, Andy, and thank you for joining us once again. You've already given me 3 hours, and now you're going to give me 2 hours tonight, so that's 5 hours. So we are really thankful for your presence here. Over.
Thanks for having me, Mel. Just by way of introduction, I'm a lawyer in private practice here in Washington State in the U.S. of A. I've been practicing for 12 years. I'm 48 years old. I hold 5 degrees, including a degree in history from UCLA and a degree in environmental law and policy from the University of Cambridge. The significance of my story is that in the late 1960s and early 1970s, as really a very young school child, I was involved as one of the children participants, one of the child participants in DARPA's Project Pegasus. And Project Pegasus was a classified defense-related research and development program that was attempting to enhance the intelligence gathering capability of the United States government by developing different forms of quantum access. The thrust of the program was essentially remote sensing in time, that is, gathering intelligence from the past and the future, from distant locations in the quantum hologram, through the development of a number of different methodologies. And they ranged everything from conventional remote viewing on behalf of the U.S. Navy, which I was involved in during the Vietnam conflict, as a gifted and talented child in this program, all the way through physical time travel to past and future events. The two principal technologies that were being developed during in the context of that project, certainly by 1970, were already well advanced, were essentially a teleportation technology that derived from the works of Nikola Tesla. Tesla's papers were never lost. When he died at the Knickerbocker Hotel in Manhattan in January of 1943, his papers were seized by 2 agents of the War Department, and they were forwarded to the physicists that were then gathering in Los Alamos, New Mexico, to build the atomic bomb. And that's where Tesla's papers remain. They remain sequestered at the Los Alamos National Laboratory because a decision was made during World War II to weaponize the potential of Tesla's work. That is the true hidden history of the great contribution to science and technology that Nikola Tesla made during his lifetime. Essentially, the infrastructure of the 21st century, embodying things like teleportation, were weaponized during World War II and have been kept secret ever since. The other major area of technical development in the project that I was directly and substantially involved in were these devices that were called chronovisors. More recently, they've been identified under the rubric of looking glass technology, for example, in Dan Burrish's testimony provided to Project Camelot. And while that term was never used when I was a child participant on Project Pegasus, I'm convinced we're talking about the same technology. The chronovisors, as they were called, derived from an accidental discovery that was made by two Vatican scientists named Ernetti and Gemelli, working at the Catholic University of Milan in the 1940s. They were working on studying the harmonic patterns in Gregorian chants, trying to split the individual voices in Gregorian chants to determine why Gregorian chants have such elevated spiritual and even healing capabilities. And they were manipulating a specialized microphone as part of their study in musicology. They were, in fact, Vatican musicologists. And something that Gemelli's father had said to him in childhood came through the microphone. And they were astonished because they realized they had accidentally discovered a means to capture a signal from a past event and amplify it so that they could perceive it. And then working with the most distinguished Italian scientist of their generation, namely the great Enrico Fermi, by 1952 they had developed a two-dimensional chronovisor, which was in the nature of a television set-like screen in which you could see past events occurring. In fact, they claimed that by that time they had remote images of the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth. Now, the linkage here is that Enrico Fermi was the mentor of the federal science administrator that my father and I had substantial contact with when we were attached to Project Pegasus, beginning in 1967-68. In fact, the first time that my father and I teleported to New Mexico from New Jersey, we met with Enrico Fermi's protege, a man by the name of Dr. Harold M. Agnew. And in 1967-68, when I was a six-year-old, my father took me up to the teleport that was then located at the old Curtis Wright Aeronautical Company facility in Woodridge, New Jersey, and we jumped through a Tesla device, which propagated a kind of a vortal tunnel in time-space. So we actually passed through very quickly through this illuminated tunnel, and we popped into view, you know, we popped out in the state capitol complex at Santa Fe, New Mexico, which for the next 5 years, when I was attached to Project Pegasus, was being used as the collection area by the teleportees. We were reappearing in the normal time-space continuum in Santa Fe. My father and I then drove over, and we met with Dr. Agnew when he was the director of the W division at the labs, the weapons division. And my father then presented a prospectus to him to involve adult and child civilians in testing involving teleportation. And so in my mid-30s, I began to reflect on what my father and I had been involved in Project Pegasus, and I realized, oh my God, this was something of historical significance. It's really my duty on behalf of humanity to go back and record and create a memoir of what happened to me when we were attached to the project. Because I, for example, was involved in everything from, you know, I mentioned conventional remote viewing for the Navy. We were being placed in the Montauk chair and induced on astral projections to moments in our own subjective future. They were doing things like spinning us to induce out-of-body experiences. But then when we had about a year of specialized training in this learning lab that I was put in, which began for me in the fall of 1969 when I was beginning the third grade, they began to, once they had trained us, given us a substantial amount of alpha intelligence training, some martial arts training, and they had worked with us to essentially educate us in like the last 500 years of historical events and advances in science and technology on these speed learning machines called tachistoscopes that had been developed by the Office of Naval Research. They had worked to enhance our ability to observe things and remember what we saw and later describe what we had seen. They honed our psychic ability through a number of exercises. So about a year into the project, beginning in summer of 1970, they began to take us to defense contractor locations and military bases in New Jersey and involve us directly in what I'm calling quantum access, but what would generally be known as time travel. We began teleporting back and forth to Santa Fe in summer of 70. In fall of 70, we began going to some of the secret locations in New Jersey where the chronovisors were located. And during those 3 years, I was really pressed to sort of the ultimate envelope of human experience, because my activities essentially fomented into a specialized mission that we had to visit the year 2045 and recover microfilm summaries of future events for the U.S. Defense Department. So during those 3 years, from 1969 to 72, I was being directly involved in time travel activities, but I was also experiencing the culture of, for example, what was going on in New Mexico, being my father's son. He was one of the project engineers. He was a senior projects engineer for the Ralph M. Parsons Company, which was the principal defense contractor involved essentially in enabling the United States government to achieve time travel by 1970. In fact, when Ralph M. Parsons bought the yacht, the private yacht of the Iranian arms merchant Adnan Khashoggi in 1972, he named it Pegasus 2 for the project, even though it had never been Pegasus 1, and he had never owned anything called Pegasus. And that, in fact, is right on the Parsons website, I believe, to this day. So about 10 years ago, when I began recording what I could remember, and the memory started coming back of what we had done on the project, I didn't know I would be where I am today, which is I have essentially 225 distillations, or basically pre-chapters for the book that I plan to publish shortly. And I'm already starting to find that the significance of the information is something that I believe is going to be soon broadcast to the entire world, because the significance of what we are involved in is that since 1970, all of us could have been traveling between distant points via teleportation. And yet, because it was weaponized and kept secret, that technical proficiency has been held back from humanity, and it's my goal to help liberate it from the U.S. Defense Department so we can use teleportation to help save our planetary civilization from, among other things, removing greenhouse gases from the atmosphere caused by conventional transportation. As for the chronovisors, I think they would be a remarkable gift to humanity, because we could inspire people, particularly children and young people, to see auspicious moments in the past and ponder them and maybe excite them to try to achieve great purposes in our time. So there's a positive capability to the chronovisors that has been held back. I'm calling for the establishment of time-based museums that would be administered by the National Archives of the United States government. Now, the negative side of chronovision is that it's a threat to everybody's privacy. Everybody who has ever lived, you know, who has lived in the past, who's currently alive, or who will ever live, their privacy can be invaded by this form of technical remote viewing that chronovision allows. So as a whistleblower, I am also speaking out so that the general public is ultimately protected from this kind of invasion of privacy. And then, kind of as a tangent to the whole story, when I was a small child, the project was already beginning to gather data about future events and put them in intelligence reports. And it was during that process of finding out what the future held that I was identified basically as two things to the U.S. government, the U.S. intelligence community, if you will. One is I was identified as the principal whistleblower on Project Pegasus. In fact, they had a copy of the book that I will soon be publishing and were reading it. So they were in the strange predicament of knowing that one of the children on the project, who was indeed one of the leading children, because I had jumped through all the hoops and was ultimately involved in the most advanced time travel that the project was carrying out, and hence I could to tell the tale of what the project had achieved. But I was also my father's son, and he was the principal technical liaison between the Ralph M. Parsons Company and the Central Intelligence Agency on teleportation. So they were in the strange predicament of not knowing what to do with this kid. And that's part of the story. The other quantum interpolation of future information into the project years, which for me occurred very early, even at the time I was being immersed in the project initially, was that the project had identified the fact that my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, is the first written work to prove that Mars is an inhabited planet. It's certainly not the first work of science or literature to conjecture that Mars harbored life in ancient times and that there are very significant ancient monuments on Mars. That tradition in natural history stretches from Schiaparelli and Lowell at the end of the 19th century all the way to the modern contributions of researchers like Richard Hoagland. But what the project had identified that is significant about my contribution to the study of Mars is that I was destined to be the first to write and present photographs proving that Mars is in fact an inhabited planet. So at this stage, my work as a lawyer and as a writer and as a whistleblower is really in two directions. As an experiencer in Project Pegasus, I'm beginning to reveal what happened on Project Pegasus and what its significance is to the direction that applied science and technology can and must take in the 21st century. We're probably going to have to apply teleportation, certainly with our burgeoning population, for example, to allow people to travel between metropolitan, you know, between transit hubs at major metropolitan locations around the world. And so I'm going to be describing that in my book. Hopefully we're going to complete a movie around that topic, a feature film around my experiences in Project Pegasus. And then the other prong of my work is essentially in the area of my Mars findings. I've been publishing them at the website of our most illustrious exopolitical leader, the Honorable Alfred Lambermont Weber, who's an old and dear friend of mine and a strategic ally of mine, at his website, www.exopolitics.com. That's where we've placed essentially the annals of the organization I started last year after I discovered life on Mars, the Mars Anomaly Research Society, or MARS. Those papers are also posted at my website on Facebook, which is the Facebook group called The Discovery of Life on Mars. So I feel I'm going to be researching and writing about Mars for the rest of my life. I'm going to be taking a hiatus periodically here to finish the book about Pegasus. But the commonality to those two areas of research is that the ultimate extent of my teleportation activities on behalf of the U.S. government occurred in the summer of 1981, when I teleported several times to Mars for reasons that essentially still remain a mystery to me. I was essentially asked to go there via a teleport that existed at a CIA facility in El Segundo, California, by a CIA officer who had been put in my life in my early 20s, a man by the name of Courtney M. Hunt. And so I'm a Mars experiencer as well. That's not really a major part of my Pegasus story, because most of what happened on Pegasus was when I was a little kid. But I've also decided to come forward as a whistleblower and also alert the people of the United States, indeed the people of our planet, that not only is Mars inhabited, not only does it have an indigenous civilization, an ecology, indeed an ecology that's quite fragile and deserving of protection, and not only does Mars belong to the Martians, but we've already been there. And so we have to enact an international treaty to protect Mars, to protect its humanoids, its animals, its ecosystem, its indigenous civilization from visitation, exploration, habitation, and even suggestions of colonization by people from Earth. So that's really what links my experiences in Project Pegasus and my contemporary Mars research, is that as a result of having teleported very frequently as a child, in 1981, when I was 19 years of age, I was asked to go up there and just sort of hang out during the first trip and then walk around a little bit during my second trip. But I ended up not doing anything very extensive on Mars except sort of visit it. You know, like you drive up from Los Angeles to Santa Barbara on a summer afternoon. It was easier to get up there than flying from, let's say, San Diego to Seattle. And so I'm also speaking out about the fact that a secret space program exists. It's not under NASA. It's under the CIA. And just as we learned when we were working on Pegasus, the primary agency coordinating those activities is DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. So that's essentially my story. I'm on the threshold of revealing what I know to everybody on the planet, and so I'm quite flattered, but also take quite seriously the fact that Cliff High has identified me as one of the two planetary whistleblowers that were predicted by ALTA, and all I can promise is that I'm going to do the best that I can in fulfilling that historical duty that's been placed on my shoulders. So that's essentially my story, and I think I'd like to let go of the talk now button and hear from Mel.
Whenever I hear you talk, Andy, I just have to sit down and think about the future. And by the way, let me just ask, let me at the risk of sounding as if I'm taking advantage of all of you who are here, before I forget, who is this second person that Cliff High mentioned? I'm not sure that I've seen the other name. So it's been you and who else? Over.
I can predict. I mean, if President Obama, you know, I've heard that he won the Nobel Peace Prize today. I haven't been able to confirm that. I've been busy with my law practice all day. But you know, if he answers my call to really level with the people of the United States and the people of the world and acknowledge that we have these advanced scientific capabilities that have been sequestered for 40 years in the United States. The ability to go from point A to point B in seconds, you know, over thousands of miles, literally in seconds, without injury. If he's going to embrace my call for the truth and announce, if he's going to have the courage to stand with me in the Roosevelt room of the White House and acknowledge the truth to the people of this planet, that the planet that every 2 years comes closest to our planet, our celestial neighbor Mars, is inhabited, and that the United States government has known this for 40 years. Because one of the quantum complications of my experiences as a child when I was on Pegasus is my dad showed me my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, because it had been gathered in the future, it had been recovered in the future and brought back to the present as a result of the time travel activities that the U.S. government was then already involved in. Okay, so if he has the courage to acknowledge that not only is Mars inhabited, but the U.S. government has known this for 40 years, he indeed would become the second planetary whistleblower. Another candidate would be, I'm going to be making a public call in November for the two individuals who were principals on Project Pegasus who achieved high government office in the United States to step forward and acknowledge the truth and accuracy of my claims that I'm now making in the public realm. The first is former Defense Secretary Donald Henry Rumsfeld. Donald Rumsfeld was the defense attaché to Project Pegasus. My father and I had substantial project-related and social contact with Don Rumsfeld in the early 1970s in different cities in New Mexico. I don't know if he was teleporting there also. He may have been flying there, but he was there. He was the point man between the project itself, the project engineers like my late beloved father, Raymond F. Bishago, and other Ralph M. Parsons engineers on the project, and the Pentagon. And in fact, I was present at a meet and greet, kind of a lecture or a greeting that Donald Rumsfeld gave in a below ground amphitheater at a facility in Cerrillos, New Mexico, that's now called the Cerrillos Cultural Center. In fact, if you visit that location, you can see the amphitheater. There was a fire on the roof there at the sub-basement level, and you can look down and see this, what looks like an ancient ruin of a Greek amphitheater. But it in fact was a briefing room for the CIA during the years, 40 years ago when we were on the project. We also shared numerous meals and discussions at bars and so forth with Don Rumsfeld. In fact, in 1971, my father and I went into a bar in Albuquerque, and he and Rummy had a discussion, and my dad said to Donald Rumsfeld, "You know, Rummy, we've determined on the project that you make defense secretary." And he said, and this is a direct quote, he said, "I know, Ray, I saw that in one of the reports. But that's only that's one future event that I'm only going to believe when it happens." So Donald Rumsfeld knew in the early 70s that he was going to be defense secretary of the United States. But he is a critical figure here, because if he answers my call to acknowledge the facts that I'm now sharing, Donald Rumsfeld will become the second major planetary whistleblower. Another candidate on the Democratic side of the aisle is Governor Bill Richardson. In the summer of 1970, when we first began teleporting to the state capitol complex in Santa Fe, Bill Richardson was a 24, 25-year-old recent college grad who was essentially a young staff member on the project. And he would...
This from today's show, from the show already. So if you like to answer the questions that they have, what you're saying now, basically... They have heard it from today's show, and I just want to be able to leverage the time. I don't mean to interrupt you. Over.
My major point there is that if some of these public figures respond and do the right thing and embrace the truth of what I'm saying, those would be possible candidates for the second planetary whistleblower.
Okay, let's start with the questions. The first one comes from Forsaken Falcon from Australia. My questions are, do you know anyone who's physically traveled back to a historical biblical event? And do you know anyone who has physically met John Teeter? And by the way, you may know who John Teeter is. I personally do not believe the story, but who knows? Over.
I haven't met, and I wasn't involved in going back to biblical times. I can confirm that... very much towards the end of my experiences in New Mexico when I was a child on the project, I attended the viewing of documentary film footage about 20 minutes in length that was in black and white and very grainy of a hologram that was depicting the crucifixion of Jesus, just as Ernetti and Gemelli 20 years earlier, 1952, had recovered those images via rudimentary chronovision, a flat screen effect. This was in the nature of a 16-millimeter documentary filming of the hologram from one of the chronovisors capturing that event. Now, my father's friend Connie Chavez was a very devout Roman Catholic and Christian adherent, and she was very disturbed by that footage, as I was, just because it portrayed a man being crucified, which is an extremely cruel way to take somebody's life. And as we were leaving that viewing, my dad said, "I don't know why you're acting like you are." And she said, "Well, Ray, you know, they're killing Jesus. They're killing my Lord," is actually what she said. And my father said, "Well, we also have footage. 3 days later, there's a burst of light in his crypt, and he stands up, and two angels appear in his crypt, and they help push away the stone." So my father actually revealed to us verbally that Project Pegasus had remote images of not just the crucifixion of Jesus, but his resurrection. I don't know what I'm going to do with that particular part of the account, because it's fraught with implications. But no, I don't know anybody who ever physically traveled to the time of Jesus or the biblical accounts, but I can confirm that DARPA, I can certainly confirm through direct eyewitness experience that DARPA had images of a man who presumably they had determined was Jesus of Nazareth being crucified, and that my father had seen scenes of his resurrection.
Teeter, part of the question. Andy, over.
Well, regarding a lot of the time travel accounts that have been propagated really from the beginning of this, with the Philadelphia experiment, through the Montauk Project accounts, and then through the John Teeter story, and even also some of the independent allegations made by Al Bielek, primarily because they always involve some of the elements of quantum access as I know it was derived, because I was a child participant during the emergence of time-space exploration by the U.S. government. But there's problems with all of those accounts. For example, in the case of the Philadelphia experiment, they're talking about a huge metal ship passing through one of the vortal tunnels in time-space that Tesla-based teleportation was allowing. And I can't see where that was possible, because we had to even remove our belt buckles before jumping through the small shop floor model at Curtis Wright just to get to Santa Fe. With the Montauk account, there are some true facts, like the existence of the Montauk chair is true. The involvement of a man named Jack Pruitt is a real data point, because Jack was not only a team leader on Project Pegasus, but I met with him in June of 2003 during my first fact-finding trip to New Mexico. In fact, he gave me some critical information. So he's one of the heroes of the story. But a lot of the rest of the Montauk account makes too much out of de minimis aspects of what Pegasus achieved many years earlier. So I think it's probably a work of disinformation. And then the case of the John Teeter story, I just didn't think it made any sense. For one reason, quantum access is definitely human resource and technology dependent. So if there had been disarray, such as he described in the future, that begs the question of how he accessed the past in order to allege that he was here from the future. But to me, it just sounds like one of the legends about time travel that had been scripted to confuse the public and keep them in the dark about the fact that quantum access was developed in a very sophisticated way 40 years ago by the U.S. government.
They mixed this, and that they also made a movie. Two things that did it for me about the John Teeter story was, first, there's not going to be another Olympics. The Olympics took place nicely in China. And he also mentioned that the next president, if I remember, was going to be a woman, and there were going to be two presidents, and the United States will be divided into two, which may not sound that far-fetched. Second question comes from Firestick. Andy, do you believe that this disclosure of yours is a necessary completion of the time loop created by the, quote, technical remote viewing done earlier?
I don't think that the quantum complications that were described, for example, in Dan Bursch's testimony to Project Camelot are empirical concerns. I don't believe that I don't believe that time loops possess the problematic sort of deep quantum significance that they've been given. So no, I don't. I view my work now as the fulfillment of a spiritual decision that I made as a child to grow up and tell the story of what happened to me, because I believe that, as my father did, that these technologies should not have been kept secret. I was mistreated in the program, so I guess there's a little measure of revenge involved, but also because I appreciated the significance and the potential benefit of the technologies to my fellow human beings. And so I've been more on a personal quest to reveal what happened and to try to create political movement around the process of disclosure. And I don't believe that there's a quantum dimension to that in terms of the quantum environment, some way having to be a rift in time being healed or something like that.
Canada, Dax. Andy, why do you think the actual weapon developed by Tesla was dropped by the military when its more civilian ideas were militarized, like teleport, for example, over?
I think because modern warfare represents a pathological development pattern in our civilization. You know, Buckminster Fuller was talking about really two kinds of technology, livingry or life-advantaging technology, and killingry, basically a technology that disadvantages human life or is designed to take it. And so I think that Tesla's work was exploited by the defense industry in the same way that the works of other great geniuses have been. And that's why we need to focus on what he really achieved and what happened to it. Because his work, I can't speak so much to the death ray and the weapons that he is alleged to have made, but he clearly developed this to enable somebody to stop being at point A and start being at point B almost instantaneously, which would be of great advantage to humanity if we were doing that globally. And so I think that Tesla was a great genius, and that his work has been debased, and it has been commandeered for a specific set of defense purposes by the United States government, that maybe, if sometimes even individually justifiable, nonetheless have resulted in his work being sequestered, suppressed, not utilized to help everybody on the planet. And so that it's a mystery to me, but I think it would be attributable to the fact that we're an imperfect civilization, because we've even created an industry based on war. And it's moving past that infrastructure of killing each other that we need to achieve. And one of the ways we're going to achieve it is by creating technologies like this that, you know, in other words, implementing them so that they do so much with so little input of time and energy that we're able to take care of everybody on the planet and we don't need to have warfare.
Next one comes from Indochina. I'm sure you are probably familiar with the remote viewing work done by Dr. Courtney Brown at Emory University regarding remote viewing of Mars. And my question is, to what extent has your work on Mars been able to confirm or alternatively to call into question the postulates about current Martian society that Dr. Brown put together based on remote viewing data? Over.
Any question, because both my direct experiences in childhood related to the Martians, in young adulthood when I teleported there, and then my more recent Mars findings based on essentially natural history, where I'm scrutinizing data coming in from NASA and the European Space Agency and so forth, really does confirm a lot of the data that was gathered about Mars and the Martians by that team of remote viewing viewers that Dr. Brown assembled at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Just to really start with my experiences that would confirm his data. In the early 1970s, my father took me over to Curtis Wright just as three Martians were leaving following a liaison visit to aerospace engineers of the United States government. And I can confirm that those individuals looked essentially human. In all likelihood, they are the descendants of our relatives who were on Mars when there was a common interplanetary confederation that linked Earth and Mars before the solar system catastrophe of 9500 BC that destroyed the great maritime civilization on Earth that had built the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx and the great platform at Baalbek in Lebanon. That was a space-faring civilization, and it was destroyed apparently when debris elements from the Vela supernova explosion came into our solar system, possibly destroyed a planet, certainly severely damaged Mars, and also pummeled the Earth and destroyed human civilization as we know it at that time, although human life survived that cataclysm. But human civilization didn't recover until extraterrestrial intervention in ancient Sumer in 3000 BC. So the first data point from Brown's team that I can confirm is that the Martians, at least the Martians who are capable of coming here, look essentially like us. I describe them from a child's perspective as looking like three of any three of the four three Stooges. They were basically homely, bald, white guys in silver suits with a red crest on the chest with a yellow lightning bolt in it. The second aspect of that experience when we went over there and met the Martians right as they were leaving and getting in their, basically their conventional ship. It wasn't a flying saucer and it wasn't superluminal. It was just basically a high-speed aircraft that was hovering there in the hangar and then took off at a great rate of speed from the tarmac there. So the second thing I can confirm is that they're capable of reaching Earth and, in fact, have reached Earth. You know, Dr. Brown has alleged that there are already Martian colonies in the mountains near Santa Fe, New Mexico, and also different remote locations in South America. Well, I can't discount that because the conditions on Mars are very harsh, and I would certainly want to seek to escape Mars to a more convivial planet like Earth if I could, certainly if I was already capable of reaching Earth. So they have reached Earth. They've been in liaison with our governments here on Earth, certainly at least the United States government. The third aspect of his account that I can confirm is that when I teleported to Mars in 1981, first by myself and then in the company of this CIA agent that they placed in my life, Courtney Maurice Hunt, who had been with CIA since the 50s, the jump room that we used to access Mars opened up in an underground location. And I then walked up a stone staircase and access the surface of Mars through the eye sockets of a skull, very much like is found in my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars. There are different skulls and other objects on Mars that mark access points from the surface down to this underground civilization. So the third major data point from the Brown study at Emory that I can confirm is there is an underground Martian civilization. I don't know why they have chosen to live underground. My guess is that they fled underground after that cataclysm in 9500 BC and have essentially decided to have most of the infrastructure of their civilization underground to protect it from another barrage like they experienced around 9500 BC. So those are some of the major data points. I can't confirm that they want to move their whole population here, but I can also say in furtherance of the factuality of that study, after I published my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, in 2008, 4 days later, I received a cell phone call from a senior case officer for the Central Intelligence Agency, a woman by the name of Virginia Olds. She's actually the niece of Glenn Olds, who was the man who introduced Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger as friends, not just in government, but personally introduced them. Virginia had been a psychologist for DARPA when I was on Project Pegasus. She had worked with me in overcoming kind of a sense of existential dread that I was experiencing when I was traveling to the future on the project. And she called me 4 days after I published my paper and volunteered that, yes, my paper was accurate. In fact, that there are a million humanoids living in the underground civilization under Mars. So I would cite as the something I can definitely confirm in his study that the Martian civilization is primarily underground, although the Martian humanoids that are like us, and also the ones that more closely resemble the grays of the extraterrestrial contact literature, occasionally come up from the underground and can be seen and photographed on the surface. So there are two sets of photographs in different parts of NASA image PIA 10214 that I published in my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars. I'm currently writing a paper where I have found another image at another location on Mars where there's a bald male Martian in like a black caftan, such as people in the Middle East on Earth sometimes wear. And also the Italian lawyer Antonio Di Bello has furnished me with another picture of a bald male humanoid Martian that he has recovered from an entirely different part of Mars. So I'm soon going to be publishing our third and fourth image of the humanoids on Mars that sometimes will venture up from that underground civilization that Courtney Brown's remote viewers saw, and they've indeed already been photographed, and we've analyzed those photographs.
All right, guys, now, Steve, What effect on the mind, body, and so? By the way, before I ask that question, somebody asked a question from Mel. Just rather quickly, let me answer this for Mark. Will this voice chat conference be available as an MP3 for members? Mark, the answer to your question is we don't know. This is a beta test system. We've had some trouble recording before. Justina from Greece was recording, but for some reason she signed out. I guess something happened with her computer. She was the one recording this. I think there's a couple of more people recording. The more people can record this, the better. I cannot guarantee it, but yes, my intention is to make this chat available to the members as soon as possible. So back to Steve's question. What effect on the mind, body, and soul does the teleporting have, if any? And is time change, or is it affected on a personal level after teleporting? Oh,
an interesting question. I'm going to try to describe teleportation, at least what it felt like when I was on the project as a kid. I haven't teleported since the 1981 teleportation to Mars, which was in a room where there was a different kind of effect altogether than when we were just jumping through the Tesla device at Curtis Wright and also at Sandia in New Mexico to get back to the East Coast back when I was a kid on the project. So let me just address the perceptions of a child from the point of view of where Tesla teleportation was 40 years ago, and then maybe I can describe the differences for the jump room that we used to get to Mars. Essentially, the teleportation device consisted of two gray elliptical-shaped booms that were about 8 feet tall and about 10 feet apart on the floor of the laboratory there at Curtis Wright. And when the device was turned on, they propagated a shimmering field of energy that looked sort of like water falling in a modern public art sculpture incorporating water. But when you went up about a foot to this curtain of energy, it looked like raster on a television set, a jumble of white and black snow like on a television set. But you could see little squiggles of blue-green light moving across that field of raster. When you jumped through that field of energy, you found yourself... I always had the sensation that I was moving forward and down, but also nowhere at the same time. You sort of leapt into this hyperspace where you had the sensation of forward movement, but it was almost like the universe that consisted of the tunnel was moving past you rather than that you were moving forward, like let's say when you drive in a car through, oh, I don't know, the Lincoln Tunnel in New York City. So you entered this interstitial chasm in the time-space continuum. And on the walls of this tunnel, this chasm, you could see streams of semi-transparent light moving past you. And sometimes when I would turn my head, I would see snippets of events going on in that superluminal envelope of the tunnel. So the best way I can describe it is not as wormholing, but as rushing through a hole that had been ripped open in the time-space continuum. And then after a few seconds, we would see a light in the distance, and it would suddenly get very close, and we would then complete our footfall in Santa Fe, 2,005 miles distant, that we had started when we jumped through the energy field back in New Jersey. So I can say that psychologically, it was very shocking to the sensibilities of a child to jump through a curtain of light and then just at a tremendous velocity have the universe wrapped around my head. I think, in fact, they're preparing the public for this kind of sensation in all of this fast cinematography that we're seeing in modern feature films, where everything's being blown up and you're in a car, you know, jumping through hoops that are on fire and so forth. We're being conditioned. I think our sense organs are being conditioned for this sort of violent, deracinating effect of teleporting, which may be a necessary thing that we're going to have to get used to if we want to go from one city to another in a couple of seconds. Physically, there was apparently no physiological impact. I mean, I remember getting kind of feverish sometimes, somewhat dehydrated. When Rumsfeld gave his meet and greet there in spring of 71, he mentioned that the only known side effect that the teleportees were experiencing was dehydration. And so he just encouraged us to drink more water when we got to New Mexico or back to the states on the east coast of the United States or in the eastern United States where we were from. It was certainly no more frightening to a child, I would say, than a very frightening amusement park ride. So we got used to it and actually started to enjoy teleporting after doing it a couple times. In fact, when we were told that we were longer going to be teleporting back and forth between New Jersey and New Mexico, one of the other children in the project started crying. Because we were having fun ultimately doing, we were even yelling Geronimo sometimes before jumping through the device. It was something that certainly children could get used to. I think certainly older people and less adventuresome people and infirm people might feel somewhat psychologically challenged by jumping through this hole in time space, because it certainly, it always seemed to hold the threat that you would fall through time itself. You know, there's a scene in this new comedy, this new Will Ferrell comedy called, I think it's Land of the Lost, where he goes over a waterfall and falls through a hole in time. So initially it did have that sort of frightening dimension. You felt like you were going to fall through time itself and never be recovered. And that was certainly a psychological fear that I sometimes had when we were teleporting. Physiologically, I mentioned the dehydration, the sense of acceleration, some sense of feverish thoughts and disorientation when we would suddenly alight there in the state capitol complex in Santa Fe. And then, of course, whatever the physical effects were later in life from all that chronic dehydration and probably radiation. There was one project-related injury when I was on the project, and that was to a boy who popped into view standing in a public fountain that had been leaking. And there was about 3 inches of water in the bottom of this fountain there in Santa Fe. And as a result of the specific density of the water being more dense than the surrounding air, his feet arrived, I guess, a millisecond or so later, and he slid off his feet at the ankles and sadly, quite tragically, lost his feet. So there were project-related injuries resulting from the fact that this was experimental, dangerous activity when I was on the project. Many of the teleportees have begun developing a disease of metabolic regulation that leads to either a disease that mimics diabetes or that results in tremendous weight gain. For example, one of the teleportees, Jack Pruitt's son, Glenn Pruitt, died several years ago after reaching a weight of 700 pounds. And so Jack was reaching out to individuals like me as early as 2003, and I'm just avoiding a high glucose reading and obesity by essentially abstaining from carbohydrates. So that's another reason I'm speaking out, is because other people who have secretly teleported for the U.S. government need to know that they should essentially be limiting the carbohydrates from their diet and definitely being engaging in glycemic indexing of their diet, just as a type 2 diabetic would. With the teleportation that we did from the jump room at the CIA facility in El Segundo in 1971, the only strange thing about that I can really describe is the thing went up, and I didn't really have a sense that we were going to Mars, but then about halfway through this 15 or 20 minute trip to Mars, the dimensions of this elevator that was the jump room started morphing into more of a cylindrical shape than a rectilinear one, and there were tremendous sensations of pressure. I'm a scuba diver. I learned how to scuba dive when I was interested in working with Captain Jacques Cousteau, who I was writing for in the late 1980s. I wanted to get on his ship, so I learned how to scuba dive. Unfortunately, I didn't get invited onto the Calypso. But nonetheless, I would describe the kind of pressure that kind of teleportation created was sort of like the kind of pressure on your ears and your body that you experience at about maybe 50 feet underwater. There was definitely pressure to every part of the body that was exposed, and it was relatively unpleasant, but by no means as difficult as what I just did yesterday, which is I flew from Portland, Oregon to Anchorage, Alaska, and that was much more fatiguing than teleporting to Mars via the jump room at El Segundo. So again, they've standardized it. God knows what they've done since 1981. I'm sure that the teleportation is even more seamless and less impacting on human psychology or physiology as a result of the 28 years of development that they undoubtedly have been engaged in since 1981, when I found that teleportation to Mars was not particularly stressful or difficult to undertake.
If the late Dr. Atkins were alive, he would probably hire you as a spokesperson for the Atkins Company. At any rate, MJ Defish, please tell us about other kinds of off-worlders in our solar system. Have you met any hominid appearance, folks from other dimensions? Over.
The conventional set of alien contact experiences in childhood, and I had one in my teens. when I reconstructed or essentially deconstructed those contacts, I'm fairly convinced that they were investigating me, because as a child time traveler on Project Pegasus, I had stepped on their terrain, which is that fourth and fifth dimensional terrain that time travel takes place in. Clearly, we're not being visited by extraterrestrials per se from in spaceships. We're truly, in the truest sense, we're being visited by interdimensionals in time ships. And so I had a set of contacts with advanced extraterrestrials throughout my childhood. And when I kind of mapped them and explored what they were doing with me and when they appeared in my life, I think I was being kind of evaluated by them, because I was stepping on their territory, which is that superluminal range where time travel occurs. And I don't have a lot to add to the literature. I mean, I have some colorful anecdotes that I can tell you about what I experienced in contact with extraterrestrials, but I don't think they really add to the UFO literature very much. There was one episode of Alien Liaison on Project Pegasus when we were in New Mexico, when a kind of a summit meeting between two extraterrestrials who were permanent guests of the United States government met with myself and one of the other children on the project. And that was just sort of an encounter between them and us. And they had much larger heads and faces than have been depicted in the mass media depictions of the Greys. I think that, in fact, the more extraterrestrial-looking Martians that I've identified in some of NASA's photographs look more like the apparent extraterrestrials I had contact with in childhood in these kind of mundane contact experiences like millions of people around the world have had. So I don't know if those are the Martians with the big heads and the spindly bodies that have been contacting us on Earth. I don't think they are, because the images that I've recovered of the Greys on Mars shows them engaged in relatively rudimentary activities. I haven't found any evidence of...
Is everybody hearing? I lost contact with Andy. Andy, there?
My finger slipped off the talk now button here. I was just saying that I don't think that the Greys or the other advanced extraterrestrials of the contact literature are Martians. I think they're from elsewhere, probably distant star systems. So my work isn't really presented as a refutation of extraterrestrial theory within modern ufology. I think they'd have to be occupying the kind of ships and entering people's minds the way they have been. All I'm saying is I think they may have been investigating me, maybe with more heightened interest, because I had made myself known to them by doing things like jumping through vortal tunnels in time-space. In fact, during one of my jumps, I looked quickly to my right. I mean, I looked to my right as the forward momentum stopped, and there were some Greys standing there watching me. So I don't know how that resulted, but I think they were investigating Project Pegasus, and that my alien contact experiences are attributable to having been involved in time travel activities by the United States government, rather than my memories of being Pegasus were implanted in my minds by aliens. That's already been disproved, because I found physical evidence of my presence in New Mexico. So, but I am a contactee and have to simply be truthful of that, because that's part of my past, as well as being a child experiencer in Project Pegasus.
To the device, but once teleported to the past, for example, Gettysburg, how did you return without affecting those around you? How did you find that energy field again?
One of the potential threats to the validity of my story is, for example, when you went to the past, how were you recovered? And let me explain this, because we're really talking about different devices. So let me just cover some of the devices. Okay. When we first started being immersed in the holograms that the chronovisors were producing, they were initially three-dimensional chronovisors. They were simply the two-dimensional chronovisor that Ernetti and Gemelli had fully functional by 1952 that had been modeled into three-dimensional holograms that propagated fourth-dimensional effects, most probably at Bell Labs, because Murray Hill, New Jersey was just within 10 minutes of where all these other project locations were. And not only that, but we met William Shockley of Bell Labs in spring of 1972, and he thanked us for our involvement in the project. So initially we were being immersed in these holograms, and when we were trained for the chronovisor at Morristown by Jack Pruitt, he said that we were there in that time and space as a spectral presence, like a ghost would be in our time. So we could see and be seen by the people and animals, you know, other sentient beings of that, wherever we were sent. but that initially we weren't there. We were there in a form of virtual time travel. So actually, let me step back a little bit here. They were propagating different forms of quantum access. So the first would be conventional remote viewing, which is what? It's psychic time travel. Then they were placing us in the Montauk chair, which I would describe as psychical, technically assisted time travel to your own future, with the return of your mind to the present, just as your mind had been bumped forward in an astral projection to your own future. Then they began to immerse us in the three-dimensional chronovisor, and we were just a spectral presence. We were being involved initially in a form of virtual time travel. Now, there was a paradox in regard to that, even before the three-dimensional chronovisors became fourth-dimensional chronovisors, where they were physically inserting us in the past or future. And that was that when we were in these holograms for more than 15 minutes, a density effect would occur, and we would essentially be stuck in that time and place. And the project would have to send this probe that looked like a soccer goal, and the apparatus really marked where they were wormholing into that location to extract us. So we had a set of exercises at a local military base where wherever we saw the portal, we had to run towards it. They actually sort of conditioned us every time we saw that soccer goal-like device to run like hell, because it was going to be the means by which we were extracted from being stuck, mostly in the past, because most of the chronovisor probes were to the past. And when that occurred, we would run through the soccer goal and feel ourselves kind of sucked into a tunnel effect again, and we would find ourselves running through the sand at the back of an amusement park, a dinosaur tunnel at an abandoned New Jersey amusement park. However, if we were in for 15 minutes or fewer in the hologram would simply collapse. I'm reminded of that scene in Mary Poppins where the chalk drawings on the ground collapse in a rainstorm. All the light around us that was showing us this past event would just sort of collapse and rain down, and then the other kids would pop into view as black bodies initially. You'd see an arm, a leg, a head, as initially a black mass, and then you'd start seeing the kids around you. So we would be stuck in this field of supercharged particles for about 90 seconds that they said was an effect called scintillation. Okay, so we literally had to be extracted remotely when that density effect occurred. Now, when I was sent to Gettysburg, I wasn't sent via either teleportation or chronovision. I was sent through a plasma confinement chamber, which was being administered by Dr. Sterling Colgate, who was then the chair of the physics department at New Mexico Tech. And I think he went on and became the president of New Mexico Tech. But he had he went on to a distinguished career in astrophysics publicly at the Los Alamos National Labs. But secretly, when I was a child participant on Pegasus, he was administering a plasma confinement chamber that was located at East Hanover, New Jersey. And that device was a cubicle device about as big as two high school chemistry labs, and there was a big, there was a kind of a dividing line inside the apparatus, and you'd see this plasma forming on the other side of this rectilinear box. It was like a lucite box, and we would walk towards that cloud of plasma, and when we were immersed in that cloud, we would just start zipping and zapping and wormholing through space in different chaotic patterns. And I only experienced that sensation, or that whatever, the sensations of that form of time travel, for that one probe to November 19th, 1863, to Gettysburg to see President Lincoln give the Gettysburg Address. And it was at that location where I was photographed in the only known surviving photograph from Gettysburg. But the paradox of that particular kind of probe to the past was that when I was standing there, right, and actually a short period of time after that photograph was taken, I had a massive kundalini-like sensation, and I've used the verb to evanesce. I basically evanesced back to the present. I didn't wormhole back to the present. I just kind of sensed that my grip on 1863 was being lost, and I kind of had this effusive sensation where I just kind of evanesced and found myself back in the time lab. So it looks like plasma confinement was able to create some kind of density effect around somebody in a localized way that they could nonetheless calibrate and send somebody to a specific distant point in the quantum hologram, but that when that energy effect lost its grip, you suddenly found yourself back in the plasma confinement chamber, which is what happened on that one probe to Gettysburg. So there were different effects on the quantum environment that the different devices were achieving. Ultimately, in terms of actual physical time travel to the future, the jumps that we did to 2045 were all effectuated with this huge device that was called a Stargate that was set up on the floor of the gymnasium at the Cerritos Cultural Center. And that was this big, ominous, black, anvil-shaped device, almost like a huge, like, colonial-era printing press-like thing with all these different apparatus on it that had a neon-colored notch at the bottom that we would run through, and then we would teleport. We would, you know, find ourselves in a vortal tunnel and then pop into view in the future, you know, in 2045, in front of this building that we then had to walk into. So there were different effects because the devices allowed for different forms of quantum access. I wasn't really able to test the butterfly effect by going back to the past and then coming back to the present, but there did seem to be a little oblique changes in my environment where, let's say, maybe one of my siblings had said something to me the day before, and then when I would time travel somewhere and then come home from school after everything had been resolved, they would say, well, I never said that to you. So it was almost like I was always coming back to a slightly different adjacent timeline. So I do think the butterfly effect was being evinced, but not in a major way, only in a slight micro shift relative to my own position in time space.
And I had a question before I asked John 404's question. A lot of people email me saying that Stargate, the series Stargate, may be depicting true events. And even some of the things you're saying, that even the special effects, somebody from Germany said, do you believe that's true? And then I'll ask John 404's question.
Oh. In fact, it's such an important issue that I investigated some of the history of science fiction to figure out what really has been going on in our international culture. You know, I know to a personal, a moral, a historical certainty that not only was I in Project Pegasus, but that it involved time travel technology that was then emerging, you know, 40 years ago. And the reason I know that is, apart from my own subjective memories and my own investigation for the last 10 years about what I remembered happening, I have statements from 12 individuals, some of them prominent in government, some not. Several are deceased, but still 10 of them are still alive, who I'm going to name, and I'm going to state what they corroborated during my investigation. So my point there is that the historicity of my account has been reality tested with other people's understanding of what was going on during those years. I'll just cite one person, because he's a really nice guy, and I don't think he'd be offended by me discussing this publicly. And that is Cliff Harris, who was one of the climatologists working with Dr. Ivan Browning when he was the director of science and technology at CIA, provided me an account of the fact that everything I was describing had been talked about by Ivan Browning when they were working together on the CIA's Ice Age studies of the early 70s. So I have accounts like that where if somebody's not still alive, perhaps one of their colleagues has corroborated what they were talking about. But I have numerous corroborating statements that show that my memories were not created by something else, to include delusion, fantasy, implantation from mind control, implantation from alien contact, etc., or, you know, just fiction, you know, a fictional account or whatever. I have the corroboration of other people's understanding of reality, what happened during those years, and the fact that I was in the project. In fact, I even confirmed that I was in the project through Ernest Garcia, who was the Army security attaché to the project. He remembered me. Okay, so we know that. Now, in the intervening 40 years, we know that one of the purposes of science fiction has been to allow the permanent secret government of the United States to drop memes, to drop data points and facts and technical proficiencies and so forth into science fiction to achieve a major disinformational impact. And that is to be able to say, oh, you're talking about that stuff that you did for the government, you know, as a child time traveler, or a quantum physicist who was then brainwashed to forget what you did. Okay, well, listen, you're just watching too much television. I saw that teleportation thing on Star Trek. Okay, so they created a literary genre so that they could point to the true facts that they were dropping into fictional accounts and attribute it to this new realm of scientific fantasy called science fiction. We know some of the deep political substrates of the creation of science fiction by the U.S. intelligence community. Many of these prominent science fiction writers have, in fact, been on government salary. We know, for example, that the honorable, truly ingenious, but nonetheless compromised, Sir Arthur C. Clarke occupied a desk next to Robert Heinlein at British Intelligence during World War II. I'm sorry, that's too close of a connection for me. That's just too coincidental. I'll give you another example of a distinguished work in science fiction or fantasy that was actually a disinformational ploy crafted to conceal what was going on in Project Pegasus. And that was Madeleine L'Engle's book, A Wrinkle in Time. Not only does the child in the story ride on Pegasus, but the time travel device is described as a tesseract, which is a conjunction for Tesla energetic array. And not only do I know we were jumping through Tesla energetic arrays, but one time my dad showed me a lab manual from the project that had a photograph of one of the Tesla devices, and the caption of the picture was Tesla energetic array. We also have the fact that the protagonist in A Wrinkle in Time was named C.W. for, I think his name was Charles Wallace. And that was concealment about the fact that the major teleportation hub on the East Coast was Curtis Wright. Now, when I read A Wrinkle in Time, I took that book, which was on all the bookshelves of you know, fifth graders and eighth graders around the country at that time, and I took it to my father. I said, look, Dad, there's a Pegasus in here, and that's the name of our project. And there's a tesseract, and that's the Tesla energetic array. And the kid is named C.W., just like we're going to Curtis Wright all the time to jump to New Mexico. And he said, I know, son, it's a form of literature that we've developed in the intelligence community. We've developed science fiction to achieve what's called disinformation. And I said, what is it? And he said, well, it's basically a way to give people some of the true facts, but to confuse them about the facts that have emerged, and to also mislead them about major issues like how the technologies work, such as we saw in Star Trek, where teleportation was being done in the opposite way that it was then being done by DARPA. So when we look at the emergence of this really extremely creative and admirable work of television in the area of science fiction, basically Stargate Atlantis, we find that the very first episode of their show was entitled Project Pegasus. And Stargate, which was the most advanced quantum access technology that they had operational by 1972, I can confirm, was placed right in the title of their show. So unfortunately, for people like me who have had real personal experiences of serving the United States government and the people of the United States and the people of the world in these classified defense projects, we've been subjected to the ignominy of having our true accounts besmirched because key facts from the projects we were on were placed in science fiction. And so although I love the works of Arthur C. Clarke and Robert Heinlein, although I think A Wrinkle in Time by Madeleine L'Engle is a great work for school children to read, I read it myself as a school child, and as I said, took it to my dad for an explanation. And while I think it's great that people are learning about what the future could hold through science fiction fantasy, something very culturally corrupt has happened, and that is the concealment of true facts in this new genre called science fiction. So I can confirm that the Stargate term was used in Project Pegasus, and Project Pegasus was indeed the project title of the U.S. time-space exploration program at the time of its emergence around 1967-68. And it was, I guess, the prospect that they knew about of me and others coming forward that caused them to craft such a phenomenal TV show around some of the same data points.
Information about science fiction, and we all suspect that. This question comes from John from Canada, and I'm glad you asked it, John, because I wanted to also. And by the way, tonight I was coming to the studio. I looked up, and I did not see the moon anywhere. And the first thing that came to mind was, I wonder if the bombing really happened. So here's a question. Hi, Andy. John from Alberta, Canada here. Pleasure to meet you and take part in this chat. I hate to steer away from Mars and teleportation, no pun intended, but do you have any opinion on what the recent El Cross moon mission was truly about? Was NASA really doing a water experiment, or was there something else to it? Over.
I think the best thing that's ever been done on it was the Examiner piece that was done by my friend and colleague, Alfred L. Weber. I have no idea. I do know that NASA has been used over the years to create a conception in the mind of the public that it's undertaken the most advanced human activities in space and on other planets. The fact that we don't know the answer to that question, just like we don't know, NASA hasn't confirmed the evidence found in its own data that Mars is inhabited. NASA hasn't revealed the existence of the secret space program that the CIA has been using to teleport people to Mars. You know, David Wilcock claims that there are 600,000 humans on Mars, and I can't discount that because I was there 28 years ago. So essentially, NASA, we need to launch a reform movement within the United States government to appoint a very talented administrator, a very unique individual, to become the director of NASA and redirect NASA to its original historical purpose. Under the NASA Act of 1958, the primary mission of NASA was to foster the expansion of human knowledge of space. And you know, the mere fact that intelligent people like yourself are still in the dark as to why they're bombing our closest celestial neighbor in condign violation of the treaties protecting other celestial bodies is really a measure of the degree to which NASA has drifted from its legislative mandate. We should all know why NASA is bombing the moon, and we've been given some superficial explanations, but we don't know whether this is a disinformational ploy to distract people from my Mars revelations, or whether there's a legitimate scientific or military objective, and that's not the way that NASA was supposed to function. NASA was supposed to be a civilian scientific agency for research and exploration that was going to be sharing its information with the public in the same way I'm trying to share my findings about Mars with everybody and my experiences on Pegasus. So I think this whole lunar incident undertaken on the late John Lennon's birthday, of all things, is really a measure of the degree to which NASA has drifted from its historical mission and how we need to place it back on its mission and once again make it a civilian agency engaged not in attacking other planets or creating a military presence in space, but in leading the effort to explore space on behalf of all humanity.
I think the bombing actually happened. I heard from somebody today that there was a woman's voice just seconds before the bombing was to take place, and apparently she sounded puzzled as to what happened. So have you received any information, or did you see back then during the time of Pegasus of this event? And also regarding Cliff High from the WebBot project, he stated that this could be the catalyst or the tripwire event that could start the alien wars. Any comment on that? Over.
Middle position on exopolitics. I mean, I think that I support creating an international space program involving representatives of the entire human race, not just national groups, but even different local regional ethnic groups. In other words, I think we should create a cadre of both astronauts and chrononauts representing all of the different tribes of the human race and create an international program that would undertake a program of research and exploration in outer space, additional presence on the moon, a limited engagement with Mars in consultation with the Martians, and that we should demilitarize space. I'm not a space and peace activist because I kind of take the middle position. I mean, as we venture out into the cosmos, I think there's a prospect that we'll meet very advanced peaceful civilizations. We may meet very regressive, aggressive civilizations. And we may meet civilizations that are very much like our highly flawed human civilization, where we have a mix of idealistic people and activities, but also violent and aggressive people and debased human activities. So I think that we should launch an intelligent international space program that's resilient and can adjust to all of the different kinds of civilizations we might encounter in space. I think we owe that to ourselves as a human civilization on Earth that is now capable of space and time-space-based exploration of the cosmos. I don't know why they decided to bomb the moon. It's certainly illegal under public international law. It is certainly something that should not have occurred if NASA had abided by President Obama's call for change, because we have to change the view where we view other planets like Mars and the moon as either our dump for our garbage, or a place for us to simply visit and then colonize, or in this case, to attack with projectiles. These are irresponsible activities just from the point of view of extending the precautionary principle of public international environmental law to other celestial bodies in the cosmos. But the deep political significance of these kinds of actions is that because we now know from my Mars findings that in other words, you can see in my Mars findings that Mars is inhabited, we have to be cautious regarding other planetary bodies in the cosmos and respect their territorial integrity. Because in the cases of those that are inhabited, we don't want to make enemies of benign or, you know, neutral populations on planets that would seek to simply meet with us and have diplomatic relations and maybe even enter into cooperative agreements with us by either bombing their planets or visiting them for the purpose of colonizing them, like as distinguished a space scientist as astronaut Buzz Aldrin just suggested we do regarding Mars. Here we have the second man to land on the moon calling for the colonization of a planet in our solar system that unfortunately is already inhabited. You know, Mars doesn't belong to us. It belongs to the Martians. I don't know whether there are humanoids on the moon, but there might be. I do know that very intelligent Mars anomalists like Emily Windsor Craig have told me that the moon is also inhabited. I don't know whether it is or not, but we certainly shouldn't be bombing other planets. We shouldn't be extending the pathologies, the pathological technical developments and vectors of our civilization out into the cosmos. We should use the threshold that we're on to achieve a peaceful, sustainable space age, time space age civilization on Earth, and then travel out into the cosmos on a cooperative basis, being able to protect ourselves from hostile civilizations that we might find, but also presupposing and hoping that the other humanoid civilizations that we encounter in the cosmos are peaceful and that we can learn from and that we can create truly an interplanetary universal civilization on Earth. So this is a horrific development. We shouldn't even be bombing the moon because it represents an environmental commons. We should be protecting it under the precautionary principle, just like we would protect a desert on Earth that has endangered species on it. So I oppose this. I decry the need for it, and I think we should all oppose the militarization of space and these kinds of thoughtless scientific probes, if in fact that's all that it was.
To Alfred Weber when he was with me a few months ago, the moral ground, the morality that this type of action may have. Imagine just, we don't know, really don't know if there's life in another planet and just go there and bomb it just because we want to see if there's water. There must be morality involved there. But yes, I've had this question ever since you mentioned Courtney Hunt on our show, and you mentioned Courtney again tonight. Any chance of a relation, any relation to the infamous E. Howard Hunt? A lot of Hunts employed by the CIA.
Oh. That's a, you know, profound question in deep politics. He indeed was a Hunt. He was a cousin of both the Watergate conspirator E. Howard Hunt, and he was a relation to the Hunts of Texas, the dynastic Texas oil family for whom the patriarch was Haroldson Lafayette Hunt, who was implicated possibly in that Sweet 8F group that may have been responsible for the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas, on November 22nd of 1963. He was connected through the Hunts of Texas through their Orange County, California relations. But as you will find in my account, although Courtney had a very gruff exterior and he sort of physically resembled those kind of Anglo-Saxon patriarchs in the United States, sort of the old Boston Tea Party crowd that would include somebody like Richard Helms. You know, those people who founded the United States, taking the flag of the East India Company and turning into the Stars and Stripes, were the pirates. You know, the revolution against the British crown began with these pirate families who were accumulating their wealth in Massachusetts and Virginia and overthrew British rule in the United States so that they could enjoy their own dynastic wealth that they were accumulating. So Courtney was from that ilk. He had a very cynical sense of humor. He was a person who was intimidating to deal with. You know, and as I said, he looked like one of those scary CIA guys like Richard Helms. But as you'll see in my account, he's actually one of the heroes of the story because over many years he was sharing enough information with me to enable to put my story together because he understood who I was. In fact, he revealed to me shortly before he lost the ability to speak in 2001 after he had a stroke that I was, in fact, one of the bridges to the 21st century that Bill Clinton, when he was president, asked all of us to be, in the sense that I was going to link the time travel research of the early 1970s to its implementation in the 21st century. So even though Courtney may have engaged in some dastardly activities for which he should not be proud and which we should all be critical of, while working for an organization as morally compromised as the Central Intelligence Agency, he is in fact one of the heroes in my story because he helped facilitate its telling in a pretty profound and extensive way.
The button, Andy. Andy, can you hear me, guys? Over.
I've released the button, so I'm just waiting for you to go forward.
Andy, can you hear me? Over. We lost you.
Can you hear me?
After you were saying that even after he was in 2001, you were talking to him. Okay, sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead. I don't know if you finish the answer to the question. Over.
That Courtney Hunt was a Hunt, and as you said, many Hunts have been associated with U.S. intelligence community activities, and I was just describing that by attributing it to the fact that when the Central Intelligence was founded as the Office of Strategic Services during World War II, they brought in a lot of graduates of Yale, a lot of members of Skull and Bones, and although Courtney M. Hunt was not from the Eastern establishment per se by being a Yale graduate, he was descended from the dynastic Hunts of Texas and of Orange County, California, and in that sense was part of that realm. But I was just in fairness to his memory, I just want to articulate the fact that he's, in a sense, one of the heroes of the story because he enabled me over many years to put things together that allowed me now to tell a coherent story with, I think, at probably great risk to himself. He was really trying to give me enough information to tell the story, and he did. So I think he did a good deed there towards the end of his life.
Well, I was reading your question about the contamination of water. That's implying that you believe they use nukes. And the information I've received that it's not nukes. It's 22,000 pounds.
Follow up with some of the written questions then until Mel comes back on mic. I don't know whether the East India Company was the biggest shareholder in Australian development in the 18th century and whether they still hold a large portion, but I can certainly confirm that we know that the East India Company developed its wealth over three centuries, basically from around 1600 to 1900. And certainly the creation of the country of Australia as one of the crown jewels of the Commonwealth involved holdings by the British East India Company in Australia. So I think that's a very good question. I think that's probably the case. We have a question here about 22,000 pounds. I'm not sure what that means. Is that the amount that they bombed the moon with?
Answer that. Can you hear me all now? Over. Just answer if you can hear me. Over. Great. Okay, the 22,000 pounds, what I was saying, it's Rambo from Germany asked if why bomb the moon if it was going to be nuclear. Rambo, and contaminate the water, if water is what we were looking for. I don't think, the information I've received, it's 22,000 pounds of TNT. But what I was saying, laughing, was that NASA never has a straight answer, so we don't know. Oh.
I don't know if it was 22,000 pounds, but I would just like to say that we haven't yet really applied the precautionary principle to planet Earth, and I would even urge that before we do, we should apply it to other planets, because then the envelope of protection that we'll create for our planetary ecology on Earth will be extended first to the cosmos, and I would think that would be in our interest, because we don't know what we're going to find on other celestial bodies that are not occupied by other humanoids or other animals or civilization that may be of great strategic value in terms of achieving sustainability of life on Earth. So we should begin drawing the line of the implementation of the precautionary principle and not act in regard to other celestial bodies in the absence of an understanding of what our activities are going to do. And I don't think we possess enough understanding of the environment of the moon to begin bombing it with 22,000 tons of conventional or nuclear explosives.
This is the question I read, and apparently you didn't hear me. Mr. Bashago, this is from Mark. Mr. Bashago, can you give us an update on your podcast? Of when do you foresee your podcast beginning, and what books/authors do you recommend to prepare for all this unfolding of global awareness? Great question, Mark.
I'm going to be establishing the podcast at www.projectpegasus.net. It's also going to be simulcast at projectmars.net. We're still in the works of designing those websites, and once we do, it's going to begin very, very quickly, probably for about 90 minutes on Sunday nights. We're thinking of possibly 7 to 8:30 or maybe 9 to 10:30 on Sunday nights. We're going to try to find a time slot where people will not be competing with other media, so we still have to work that out. But the podcast should be occurring in several months once we get the websites up and running, and we're still designing those. I think what I'll do then is just continue. There's a question here about how the Star Trek and Pegasus system of teleportation differ. In Star Trek, which I believe was first produced in 1966, an individual stands in a static location, and the molecules of that person's body are disintegrated and then reintegrated at the destination. That's, in fact, the exact opposite of the teleportation capability that emerged under DARPA in 1966-67, right around the time that Star Trek was first produced. In Pegasus, rather than being in a static location, you jump through a vortal tunnel in time-space. And rather than your molecules disintegrating, the universe was opened up around you, and you weren't reintegrated at the destination. You popped through in your original form, and the universe was reintegrated around you. So I suspect that the teleportation that was depicted on really a phenomenal TV show, namely Star Trek, of which how can any of us not be a fan? It was great television. But unfortunately, it depicted the exact opposite of the teleportation capability that had only recently emerged from the defense technical community.
Andy, can you hear me? Over. Since I left the chat room, all the questions somewhat got deleted. So start asking your questions again, unless, Andy, you can see any of them there. But I do have a question before I forget it. I will always remember, and I'm sorry I had to laugh during the show, when that man who left a tool, a screwdriver, was teleported to Africa and had to spend 6 hours coming back home. I just can't imagine what the guy went through. But in a more serious question, when you're teleported somewhere else, how do you actually return? Shouldn't there be a teleportation device to bring you back home? Or did that happen because the technology was being developed at the time and it was not perfected? It's a two-pronged question. That's the first part. And the second part, is the same teleportation system used to teleport not only to different parts of this planet, but to anywhere on the solar system, the galaxy, the universe, etc.? Over.
The question, and it also allows us to emphasize some of the differences in these different forms of quantum access technology. When you teleport physically through time-space via the propagation of a vortal tunnel, the universe is being opened up around you, and you're passing through to another location, to a non-local point in the quantum plenum, as Dr. Mark Cummings has called it. I tend to use the term the quantum hologram, although I'm finding people are confusing that with the more localized holograms that the chronovisors propagate. So perhaps we shouldn't use the phrase the quantum plenum. In the case of the device at Curtis Wright, we would then pop into view in Santa Fe and be involved in different activities, educational activities, field trips, training exercises, and so forth, at different locations in New Mexico. And then we would be driven by automobile to an identical room at the Sandia National Labs adjacent to the Kirtland Air Force Base in Sandia, New Mexico, which is northeast of Albuquerque, New Mexico. So yes, we needed an identical device to get back to New Jersey, just because they wanted to return us back about an hour after we had left so they could conceal project activities. I mean, we could have walked home, you know, hitchhiked for 2,000 miles. We could have flown. We could have driven on a bus, taken a train. But if they wanted to get us back in a time-urgent way, they had to have us teleport home, and we were always teleporting via an identical teleport that is, at least then, was located at the Sandia National Laboratory. And for some reason, the very furnishings of the room had been made identical. Even the number two pencil and Dixie cup on the windowsill were identical to the room in New Jersey. I think because when they accidentally discovered the application of the device of Curtis Wright after prototyping a drawing in Tesla's writings, they wanted to keep the room in the same configuration if in some way the room was acting as part of the device. Maybe they had tried to move it into another room and it didn't work or something. I don't know. Now, in the case of the Stargate device, when we jumped through that and went into the far future, from 1972 to 2045, we went into a building where by 2045, the teleportation device was recessed into the wall of a conference room. So when we got there and asked them, how are we going to get home? They said, by running against that wall. And initially, I was unwilling to do it. I didn't want to just slam my face into a wall. But in fact, we leapt towards the wall, and we found ourselves in a vortal tunnel leaping home. And then we alighted on the grounds immediately surrounding the microwave tower at the Lobo Overlook site north of Pagosa Springs, Colorado, the so-called Continental Divide site. Then in the case of the teleportation via jump room that we undertook to Mars several times, or I undertook several times, once by myself and then with Courtney in summer of 81, the jump room went up there and opened up, and then I stood in the jump room again and the door closed after sitting in the corner of the jump room like you'd sit in an elevator that wasn't working for like a half hour or so. The doors closed and I found myself going through the same kind of sort of compressive effects, and then found myself back in an office building in El Segundo, California. So teleportation, where you have physical movement of the person between two distant non-local points in the quantum plenum, requires a device on the at the destination to get home through. And it was for that reason that the physical teleportation was initially limited to just going across the country by several thousand miles. And then they expanded the ambit of that into the distant future with the Stargate device. And in fact, there were technical people in the future who were helping them. At one point, they repaired the Stargate at Cerrillos. And we asked them what year they were from, and they said 2045. That fact had been kept back from us. Now, the other forms of accessing events in the distant future differed from teleportation. They were initially virtual time travel via chronovision, and when the density effect occurred, we were essentially rescued from that area of the quantum plenum with the probes that they would insert that they were calling them portals that they were inserting. That was the soccer goal like contraption that we would use to access the time tunnel basically to get home in. When you were just doing rote majeure physical teleportation, just like you would drive through the Lincoln Tunnel in an automobile, those points needed a teleportation device to get home. I didn't jump through a device to get home from Gettysburg because, as I described, the plasma confinement chamber apparently created some local distortion of the quantum plenum that sort of stuck me in that location, and then I evanesced out of it when the effects of the device wore off.
A great explanation. I have a few questions that I received via email because of when I left. So just give me 1 second to grab by order of submission. 1 second. Have you heard anything to the effect of the theory of all humans having stargates in their brains? Over.
For that theory, I don't discount it. I believe that there are untapped potentialities of the human mind that we're going to be exploring extensively during the 21st century. I think it's a very positive notion, and we should explore it. Clearly, there have been cases, approved cases, of spontaneous teleportation of human beings. One, obviously, involving avatars, different mystics who have been able to relocate spontaneously. Jesus certainly did after his resurrection, and he had been a human being. We also have the famous case involving Amy Semple McPherson, who was known to have been delivering a lecture in California when she spontaneously appeared or bilocated in Arizona. I would say that after I began lecturing about my teleportation activities beginning in October of 2004 here in Portland, Oregon, there was a disinformational story that was released focusing on spiritual teleportation. They took the original remote viewing story from 1989 and they just transplanted the word spiritual teleportation where remote viewing had been, and they described this Army program in spiritual teleportation. They even had William Shatner, you know, Captain Kirk from Star Trek, appear on the NBC Nightly News and kind of joke or sort of ridicule the notion of what teleportation could achieve if it had been achieved in American civilization like it was postulated in Star Trek. And he said, well, I could get from my home to my my agent's office in downtown Los Angeles rather than have to deal with traffic. So the issue of spiritual teleportation, which is one of the latent potentialities of our species, has already been used as a disinformational meme to discount the accounts of whistleblowers like myself and undoubtedly others who are now going to be stepping forward. But I think it's a great subject. I think we should explore further. We should study the mind. Instead of building weapons to incinerate each other or to bomb the moon and so forth and to blow the arms and legs off of little children, I think we should be spending our tax dollars around the world to study things like this in our great university research labs, to study whether somebody would not even need high technology to get from Grand Central Teleport in New York City to Union Teleport in Los Angeles through a machine, but through their own innate faculties as a human being. So I think that's a wonderful question, and I think it's the kind of thing we should be spending our capital resources on, rather than on what Buckminster Fuller called killingry. We should be designing livingry, and maybe one of the highest forms of livingry we could achieve would be both studying how to do that ourselves, but maybe also studying how to do that with technical interfaces with the human brain or mind, so that we could achieve spiritual teleportation as a practical reality. I certainly would support that.
Laura, I received an email from Neil Freer, who's going to be with us in a couple of weeks, futurist, and also quotes a lot of Buckminster Fuller. CP Risk asks, I don't know if Andy can answer this question, but I'll be curious to know if he could. What is on the moon? Over.
No, I don't know. I mean, my theory of what happened, if you look at all the publicly available information, is that when we got up there, we found the kinds of things that we're finding on Mars and that are on Mars. I can confirm because I spent several hours on the surface of Mars. You know, the whole thing that links all this data is the existence of that interplanetary confederation of planets that existed before the solar system catastrophe of 9500 BC. If you look at Hoagland's android head on the moon, you know, I published a recent kind of facetious kind of piece just sort of in honor of Dick Hoagland, because that's such a remarkable find of that robotic head on the moon that he found in a photograph that astronaut Harrison Schmitt photographed on Apollo 17. And I just quipped, you know, get a head in life, retrieve one on the moon. I think what was found there was the debris from the civilization's presence on the moon as a celestial body before the catastrophe. And what NASA did is it terminated the Apollo program, and we closed everything up and we left the moon, because to explore the moon further would be tantamount to informing the people of Earth that we're living in the second human civilization on Earth, that our previous civilization, while not being destroyed, was almost obliterated, and that it took us thousands of years to recover our grasp of mathematics and science and writing and these higher art forms and scientific practices that allow us to have any kind of decent quality of life on Earth. I think that they made a decision kind of along the lines of the Brookings report philosophy regarding extraterrestrials, that people would be too disturbed or too dispirited and become too dysfunctional or antisocial if they discovered that we're actually living in the second human civilization on Earth. But that, in fact, is the truth of the matter. That would explain also why they propagated the theories that we never went to the moon, because that's a double disinformational ploy. Rather than articulating why we went there and didn't go back, there have been individuals like Bart Sobrell who have alleged that we never went there. Well, that's a very effective disinformational ploy, especially if you add the disinformational ploy of accosting Buzz Aldrin with that theory and then having him punch you and then not be prosecuted for assault, if you get my drift. Okay, so I know we went to the moon because in the early and mid-1960s, my late father had been investigated by the FBI to be cleared to design the instrumentation for the lunar module. I mean, my dad had worked not just on becoming the dollar-a-year man on teleportation under DARPA, with reporting requirements to the CIA on the theory and practice of teleportation, you know, by the late 60s. But in the 1950s, he was one of the designers of the ramjet engine at Curtiss Wright. He showed the Air Force how to design the ramjet with the proper metal alloy that would cause it not to melt from friction in our atmosphere or from space dust when it was when the space planes that would rely on the ramjet were in the near Earth environment. He also worked on the instrumentation for the B-70, which was going to be the atomic equipped strategic bomber. I mean, my dad only got attached to Pegasus because he had been involved in other black projects regarding advanced ways of getting from point A to point B. I'm certain, based on that culture of aerospace that I was growing up in, the fact that there's a connection in my family to the Aldrin family, Buzz Aldrin's daughter Jan, who has a really exceptional soprano voice. She's a very gifted singer, sang at my sister Marie's wedding in 1980. And in that whole period, from the time I was born in 1961, when my father had already worked on several advanced aerospace projects, to the time we were in Pegasus, and then the time when we were interacting with the Aldrin family as a result of my sister's friendship with Jan Aldrin, there was never any indication from people in any way near the lunar program that we hadn't gone there. It was understood as clearly as the fact that the sky is blue and grass is green. So it's an absurd notion that we didn't go there. We went there. The anomalies can be explained as a result of perhaps even doctoring of the photographs to conceal what's up there. And I believe what's up there is simply the debris from the previous civilization. And some of that has already been revealed in things like the android head that Richard Hoagland has now published, and that we did a sort of a facetious piece about on our website at exopolitics.com. I mean, why are we still debating whether there was a human presence on the moon before Apollo 11 if Apollo 17 photographed it, and if we apparently didn't go back to conceal it? So I believe that evidence of the previous civilization is on the moon, and it's that cosmic secret that caused us not to go back.
The moon. I talked to Dr. Stephen Greer yesterday, and two things. I asked him why the astronauts looked so zombified during the first press conference, and he basically told me his uncle, who was one of the builders of the lunar module, told them that they were sworn to secrecy or be killed. And second, a few years ago, he was organizing an event, and he wanted Neil Armstrong to attend and to talk. And through a close friend of Neil Armstrong, Dr. Greer received notification from Mr. Armstrong saying that if he were to attend that event, Mr. Armstrong and his family would be killed. So very interesting. Now, question from Path to Siberia. I think we asked that question. John 404. John, Andy, do you know if the project's teleportation in time continues today under another umbrella? And let me add to, if I could, John, add to that question. Are we still using teleportation today? And since Rumsfeld told you that it was used for military purposes to deploy the troops to the main war zone as opposed to in traffic, why are we not using that in the current war scenarios?
I can confirm that I know that, notwithstanding the teleportation to Mars in 1981, I know it was still operational in 1991, because there was an incident on Pegasus where we teleported from Curtis Wright in Woodridge, New Jersey to Santa Fe. But unfortunately, when we got there, it wasn't 1971, which is the year we had left. It was 1991. And that's an event that I'm going to describe in the book. I've already written up that chapter. We basically arrived 20 years in the future and had to get home. And I kind of pulled rank because I was the captain of Blue Team among the 14 groups of 10 kids, which we were all under different battalions that had a different color. And I had received specialized training as the captain on Blue Team because we were in crisis. I said, look, I'm the captain of this group. I'm taking over. Some of the kids were crying, and we were really trying to convince the adults there to help us get home. And so I ultimately got somebody there in security to call Sandia and give them my name and say that I was attached to Project Pegasus and I was in distress in the field. And so we then got home from Sandia again, but through a device that was somewhat different than the one that existed in 1971, and I didn't know yet the jump room that I experienced in 1981. So there's a bit of a dichotomous timeline here because of the teleporting that was going on. But I know from that childhood incident that physical teleportation of human beings was still operational by 1991, which was almost 20 years after I'd been summarily kicked out of Pegasus, just as a normal operating procedure, and already 10 years after I had teleported to Mars. Another thing that makes me suspect that it's still operational are some of these incidents when you see a public figure, like all of those mental lapses that Vice President Dan Quayle had when he was Vice President of the United States. One of the effects of teleportation was that people would experience temporary amnesia. I had an incident of this that was so profound and serious when I arrived at the Santa Fe State Capitol Complex one time that I didn't know who I was, where I was, or why I was there. And I actually asked one of the other children to get the adults, whoever, whatever adult they could find, and tell them that I didn't understand who I was or why I was there. So one of the side effects that that teleportation involved was temporary amnesia. And I'm not sure they know why it was being caused. It was probably some kind of energetic effect on the way memory is stored in the human brain. But I was actually hospitalized for 3 days at the Los Alamos Hospital. And when I went back in my first fact-finding trip in June of 2003, I identified where the pediatric ward was in that hospital and actually questioned people who had worked there since the late 60s and early 70s, even though that part of the hospital is now a meditation room and the pediatric ward has been moved. But that was one of the effects, was amnesia. And if you look at some incidents involving Vice President Quayle, there were times when he suddenly showed up at a certain location and he acted like not just that he was a person of low intellect, but like he was disoriented. He didn't know what to say. One time he said that he was from Hawaii. And this kind of nonsensical babbling may have been a side effect of the fact that he had just teleported from one secret location at a military base to another. I've heard, for example, it rumored that there's a teleportation link between Carswell Air Force Base in Texas and the Pine Gap facility in Australia. I imagine that the hub of teleports has extended to at least include secret teleports at military bases among the echelon countries, which would include the United States, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And clearly the establishment of that military teleportation system would be effective in the sense that, you know, the antipodes, namely Australia and New Zealand, are the antipodes of the British civilization, because basically London and Sydney are halfway, you know, are on the other side of the world from each other. You're talking about a 24-hour plane flight. So that's my guess, is that the teleports have been set up secretly at military bases, at least in those countries, and that some of these entirely nonsensical performances by people bright enough to reach the U.S. Senate might have been side effects of them moving around the planet via these secret teleports. Now, the holograms generated by the chronovisors were used during the invasion of Baghdad during the Iraq War. The U.S. military set up images of false tanks during the tank invasion of Baghdad when they were trying to topple Saddam Hussein's regime in 2003. And the source for that information is the individual who served as the Army Security Attaché to Project Pegasus, a man by the name of Captain Ernest Garcia, who was helping me by providing information about the project, and who, as I mentioned earlier in tonight's broadcast, confirmed for me that he remembered that I was one of the children on the project. So the technologies have been used militarily, but the point is they shouldn't be used in that way. That's a debasement of the potential that they hold to advantage humanity.
And speaking of Iraq, the next question is dealing with Iraq. Why did we invade Iraq? And did you see that, since you saw September the 11th happen, and we talked about the illegal ramifications of it being, whether they were terrorists or inside, it was an inside job. The fact that we knew, there's a legal term that you discussed. But why did we invade Iraq? It's a great question. Over.
A couple data points regarding the Iraq War. One is a very kind of passing one, and that is there was a number of probes to my own subjective future that were undertaken during one of those summers that I spent in New Mexico with my father before teleporting back to New Jersey on the afternoon of the day we had originally left. So my book's going to describe how I spent 4 extra summers in New Mexico during the 3 years between fall of 1969 and spring of 72. During one of those summers, I was working with an individual. He's a rather prominent person. I don't want to name him now, but I'm going to try to approach him to come forward and corroborate my claims. So just tactically, I can't reveal who this is now. But he's a prominent person in parascience who was working with me in the Montauk chair in one of the New Mexico research labs, giving me a small dose of a metabolite of mescaline to experiment with the use of hallucinogenic drugs and the Montauk chair to see whether the expansion of the human consciousness with a child who was being magnetically induced to experience his own future could result in clear images of the future using basically this, because the benefit of the Montauk chair and even enhancing its effects with psychedelics is that you would be able to gather information about the future without having to send somebody there. That's why I think they were still carrying on these more de minimis forms of quantum access, even though we'd already achieved physical teleportation to other times and places. And it was in that context that I was asked by this individual, what did you see? And I said, smoke over Baghdad. And he said, why? And I said, because we're bombing it. And he said, why are we bombing it? And I said, because we're going to invade it. And he said, why do you see yourself seeing this? What are you looking at? And I said, CNN. And he said, what are we doing? And I said, toppling Saddam. And he said, did you say toppling Saddam? And I said, yes. So I was able to see in that Montauk chair probe the initial bombardment of Baghdad. I guess that was in what, around February of 2003? Somewhere in that time frame. I don't know exactly. February, March 2003, I think it was. So that was just one of the remote viewing exercises that was achieved in the Montauk chair. Another data point about Iraq, which is ancient Sumer that became Babylon, but basically the Sumerian civilization that was the foundational civilization that Iraq emerged out of many millennia later, is that when we were getting specialized education on Project Pegasus, including some of the extraterrestrial information in the so-called Yellow Book seminars, some of it derived from the extraterrestrial who was present in New Mexico after the Roswell crash, either being a survivor of that crash or some kind of diplomat that was sent later, is that when they were discussing the restoration of civilization on Earth in 3000 BC via extraterrestrial intervention in ancient Sumer, which I can certainly state corroborates Zachariah Sitchin's account of that, we were told that that the present-day Iraq was the location of ancient Sumer, that the word summer for the most favorable season of the year comes from the halcyon days of that golden civilization in ancient Sumer, when extraterrestrials uplifted human civilization and created a prosperous society there in the Fertile Crescent. But that was the foundational place where human civilization was restarted on Earth. So when people allege that the U.S. launched the Iraq invasion, to go into the Iraqi National Museum in Baghdad and seize some of the cuneiform steles and tablets that may contain literally schematics of things like stargates, I can't discount it, because we know that that civilization in ancient Sumer in 3000 BC, from which modern Iraq emerged, was the location on Earth where this extraterrestrial civilization had based itself and could very well have been a time-space faring civilization that came here through, you know, via stargates and so forth. So we can't discount the possibility that the invasion was propagated to seize that information. And I think that's certainly an important area of inquiry as we explore the extent of the time-space cover-up and also some of the secret purposes of these wars that are presented as wars of international policing functions, when in fact there may be an intelligence function that is being masked.
This one from AMJD Fish: is interdimensional travel in a ship different? Is it supraluminal or extraluminal? Over.
Question, because it really encompasses some of the eras of U.S. time-space physics that I was exposed to. When we were jumping through the Tesla device, just this shop floor model at Curtis Wright, in fact, I didn't mention it was in Building 68 at Curtis Wright, we not only were not surrounded by anything, but we had to take off our boys' belts, and we had to put on these cloth belts with a plastic clasp that looked kind of like the belt on a Boy Scout uniform, and it was striped cloth. So I always feel kind of silly that I was taking off my leather belt and putting on this cloth kind of striped belt. And so beyond that, we were just wearing our normal street clothes. We weren't surrounded by anything. I'm going to be describing in the book, I've already described it in, I believe, in my some of my radio accounts, that when we were in the Chronovisor probe 2013, that took place on November 5th of 1971 at ITT Defense Communications in Nutley, New Jersey. And I remotely viewed the fact that the Supreme Court building in Washington was under about 100 feet of water. In fact, brackish water. In other words, there was algae on the columns of that building. I was surrounded. We were wearing this protective clothing that consisted of a titanium-covered jumpsuit, like a spacesuit, and a crystal helmet. But most of the time traveling we were doing in Pegasus was just like you would jump on a bus. We weren't wearing anything special. Now, the jump room at the CIA facility in El Segundo, California, was a structure. I don't know what it could have been made of to push it through a vortal tunnel in time-space, but it had to have achieved that because it opened up one floor below ground on planet Mars. So I don't know the materials they're working with. They're probably non-metallic, and they may be some form of ceramic or maybe like the Kevlar material that was derived from, apparently according to Philip Corso's information, was one of the advanced technologies back engineered from the Roswell crash debris, along with, what else did he say, night vision, the microprocessor, the transistor, and fiber optics and so forth. I don't doubt it because I clearly believe that the jump room that we used to get to Mars had to be some kind of revolutionary material just because of the intense pressure involved. We had to be punched through that vortal tunnel to Mars in a relatively quick amount of time and not be crushed by it. So it had to be some kind of super performing material that they've evolved and haven't told us about. The other thing I can add to this question of materials and superluminal activity is I know from my discussions with Robert Beckwith, who was a GE consulting engineer, a consulting engineer for General Electric, on Project Pegasus. In fact, my father, one of the other Parsons engineers, Bob Beckwith, and myself hiked around the Bandelier National Monument outside Santa Fe, actually closer to Los Alamos, when I was a kid on the project. And I interviewed Bob twice. The first time he was being totally forthcoming with me about the fact that the U.S. government had achieved different forms of quantum access to include physical time travel. And he was calling it levitated teleportation, by the way, the basic Tesla technology involved in teleportation. I'm just calling it teleportation. But Bob confirmed that the materials on the stealth bombers and even on some of our Navy ships are entirely non-metallic. He not only claimed that the B-2 bomber, the second generation stealth, had no metal on it, and that's why it was so expensive, why the U.S. strategic bombers went being worth, you know, costing $100 million to build, and then they became cost, the stealth bombers cost $2 billion to build, which is many orders of magnitude more money to finance. But he also said he was aboard a U.S. Navy ship docked in Florida. I think he told me Tampa. And the captain on the ship showed him the device where he could move the device and suddenly relocate the ship somewhere else on the surface of the ocean. So I don't really know if I can add anything to the question of superluminal performance, but I can confirm that some of these devices that allow for very advanced time-space, physics-based relocations of the craft must be based on revolutionary materials that probably can and must be applied elsewhere to advantage human beings. I mean, if you can build an elevator-like device that can be pushed through a wormhole and not be crushed and protect a mere mortal like me, imagine how you could advantage human beings by building, let's say, an airplane out of that to protect them from the crash or whatever. So I can't really address superluminality. I'm not a physicist. I would defer to David Wilcock on some of these physics questions, or somebody like Dr. Mark Cummings, or even Dr. Michio Kaku, who I met many years ago and has a fine mind and grasp of these issues. But I do know that supermaterials have been developed, and they have been used for certain time-space applications.
That's great. And as you can see, we're just answering the last few questions because we have exceeded our time. So we have the next few questions. On the moon, there are very huge buildings, and they look like very similar. Why are the inhabitants of those buildings making it so secretive? And they're still on the moon. I'm not sure if I understand the question, but let's see. Or they should get in touch with us, but our companies and governments won't allow contact with them. He's from Germany. Rambo, over.
I don't really know the answer to that question. I think it's a brilliant question. I know that there are humanoids like us and also unlike us living apparently in a stealthy way underground on Mars. That is to say that the mere fact that they would choose to live underground rather than the surface of a planet indicates concealment. I cannot confirm that there are humanoids, you know, that there's an indigenous humanoid presence on the moon, although I mentioned that, you know, I've spoken at length with Emily Craig, and she has a very brilliant mind and has spent many thousands of hours exploring these questions. And she has stated that there are not only humans on the moon, but on planets like Venus, and there's evidence of mining equipment on Ganymede, which is one of the moons of Jupiter, she tells me. I can only confirm through personal experience and through photographic analysis that there's a humanoid civilization not only here, but on Earth, but on Mars. I think that the best explanation I can think of is that we live on a terrestrial sphere that has a biosphere that is very intact. And this is another reason why I'm speaking out, is because we have to redouble our efforts to protect our international environment, because it is a beautiful, wondrous fabric of life and life forms that is very rare in the cosmos and needs to be protected to the highest degree of application of the precautionary principle and the highest goals of sustainability that we can even imagine, much less apply, because it is a sacred gift from our Creator, and we must protect it if we're going to survive rather than perish as a species. If you look, for example, at Mars, Mars has a much more forbidding and sterile terrestrial environment. So does the moon. The moon is even worse. At least Mars has small vegetation. It has both standing water and running water, as I've already shown in my research that I've published. But both of those planets are essentially denuded of life and of concealment opportunity on the surface. So my guess would be the reason why the Martians and the inhabitants of the moon, assuming arguendo they exist, have engaged in so much concealment is because, like animals living in a desert, they're more exposed to predators. And those predators presumably would be potentially hostile species from outer space. But that's the only reason I can find. I don't think they're hiding from us. I think they've chosen to live underground because they're more compromised on the surface. I know on Mars, because I was chased by one of them, there's also the issue of predators on the surface. There are rapacious predators on the surface of Mars, both plesiosaur-like creatures and very large serpents. And I not only encountered one of the plesiosaurs when I was running back to that skull that I described when I went up there to Mars with Courtney Hunt in August of 1981, but Emily Craig and I have identified hideous scenes on Mars of serpents feeding on small humanoid bodies. And so certainly in the case of Mars, the reason for living underground would be to avoid predators on the surface. But how they evolved an advanced civilization enough to get here while still not killing off their predator species on the surface as we have striven to do on Earth. For example, in North America, the only two predator species that are left on the land are grizzly bears and mountain lions, in terms of ones that will stalk humans. And then, of course, there are sharks and so forth that will try to kill humans in the ocean. But we've really eliminated a lot of our predator species, except in certain locations in Africa, for example, where you might be eaten by a lion or a tiger or something. So I think they're probably avoiding predation on the surface, either terrestrial or extraterrestrial. But then again, I can't confirm life on the moon. Perhaps the lunar civilization would be hiding from us because we're so close to it. But I really don't know.
Not only concealment, but how about the avoidance of exposure to ultraviolet rays, since their atmosphere may not be as thick as ours? But that's just my opinion.
Because, you know, before the flood, there was a firmament, and we believe that was moisture captured in the upper atmosphere. And if you're to believe the historicity of the Old Testament, even just not from a religious perspective, but from an archaeological one, Noah lived to 777 years. So that may have been because there was the deleterious radiation was being blocked by the firmament. So that would be another explanation why the inhabitants of the moon and Mars would live underground, would be to protect themselves from cosmic radiation.
This question from Blue, he always brings these questions, and I'm sure he does the research. I heard a certain Alabama University supplies crews for the space program under the Baptist Beeson Corp. What do you know about this, Andy? Over.
frankly nothing. I've never heard of the Beeson Corporation or any linkage involving the University of Alabama to any of my information, but I don't doubt such ties because, you know, the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned the United States about has evolved to include academia and the intelligence community. It's really a military, industrial, intelligence, academic complex. And so we have a very complex system of interrelationship between the military, private companies, spies, and academics and academic institutions. So I don't doubt that some kind of scenario like that is ongoing at the University of Alabama, but it's not a subject that I know anything about personally.
John. Andy, what about the paradox scenario? For example, you're going forward and running into yourself. Did that ever happen to anybody in the project? Over.
In the book, several incidents that involve paradox. Regarding the idea of, for example, teleporting to New Mexico from New Jersey, spending time there, teleporting back to the beginning of the summer on the day you left, being, you know, bright, gifted kids who had been sort of conscripted into this program by passing many, many batteries of tests, and also being selected for reasons that I don't understand, that probably, in my case, we clearly have the data regarding the fact that they identified who I was in the future. But I'm not sure they did that for all the children in the program, because we went through battery and battery of tests, even though they had my, you know, information about my destiny, and I think that may have been part of the decisional criteria for selecting me for the program, not just for my father revealing stuff about my Mars discoveries to me and so forth. But being, you know, pretty bright kids, I wouldn't say we were geniuses, but we were bright. We asked, well, wait a minute, if you're going to send us back to the summer on the afternoon of the day we left, that means that during the duration of that second summer in New Jersey, we're going to simultaneously be doing things in New Mexico, right? And they said, yes. And they said, well, what if we have our parents take us out on vacation by, you know, plane, train, or automobile to New Mexico? Won't we see ourselves doing stuff there? And they said, yes. And they said, well, can we do that? Will you let our parents fly us to Albuquerque and see us doing stuff when we were here on Project Pegasus during the first summer of you know, whatever, 1971 that we experienced out here? And they said, no. And we said, why not? And they said, we're afraid if you see yourself and then greet each other and touch each other, there may be a huge explosion. So I had to laugh.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. So if or where there will be disclosure anytime. But hold on. Before I ask that question, there was somebody else who asked the question before. Who invented and created the Stargates? I think the answer was Tesla. I may be wrong. Over. Did you get the question? Over. Can you hear me? Over. What happened to Andy? Andy, can you hear me? Over. Everybody can hear me. Maybe he can hear me now.
Can you hear me?
I do. And the last time you heard me, I guess, was when I was laughing when the person said that if you were to touch yourself, you would cause an explosion. I thought that was, I don't know if that was true or not, but it was very funny. That, please tell me that was not a possibility. Over.
This question regarding Men in Black. Can you hear me?
Well, we can hear you. I was just mentioning that the comment about you touching yourself and exploding. That was just a joke, right? Nothing like that would have happened. I mean, I know this sounds like a naive question, but can you comment on that? Over.
I'm not a quantum physicist. You know, my degrees are in history. I did some advanced math in kind of an enrichment program under the Naval Postgraduate School at UCLA while earning my history degree. And then I went on to study law, you know, environmental law, urban planning. So I'm not a physicist. I'm really a social scientist. So I can't answer why they told us that. But as somebody who is a truth teller and who now has pretty much of an encyclopedic grasp of what I experienced and what I was told and so forth when I was on the project, that's in fact what we were told. When we set up the scenario of what if we, you know, go back to New Jersey now and you put us back literally an hour after we teleported here and we live the summer of 1971 over again and have different experiences in that second summer of 1971, what will happen if we urge our parents to let us fly out here with them and so we can watch ourselves doing things here? And they said, we're not going to let you, you do that because we're concerned that when you contacted yourself physically, like even reached out to shake your hand after seeing yourself, that there would be a very serious explosion. I think even they said even a nuclear explosion. So there actually was some effect in quantum physics that they were trying to prevent from that kind of looping from occurring. And maybe that's what our air traffic control at airports is preparing human civilization for, is to keep people from colliding with themselves once we begin more regularly traveling in time space.
A couple of questions left, Andy. Do you know if or when there will be disclosure? Anytime soon? Over. Did you get the question? Over.
I didn't hear that question, although I can see that my own audio scope is working now, but I didn't hear that question at all.
Do you believe there's going to be disclosure anytime soon? Over.
I have the broad articulation from Courtney Hunt that ultimately my work would result in full disclosure around these technologies, but I don't have a timeline that I was given by anybody in the Intel community as to when it would foment. So I don't want to create unrealistic expectations. I'm simply dedicated on a lifetime basis to this role of planetary whistleblower that has been bestowed on me. And it's something that it's a duty that I take quite seriously. So I'm not going to relent. They're going to have to kill me. And I think they may try to shut me up, but I'm going to move forward even if I have to do this until I'm 80 years old. I'm 48 now, but I don't care if, you know, I die doing this, because this is my mission that I contracted to do when I came into this lifetime. I wanted to do this. I wanted to be in this program and then reveal everything so that we could move this civilization forward. But I don't have a discrete timeline that was ever shared with me or that I ever garnered, practically speaking, when I was on Pegasus. However, psychically, one scenario that I've been seeing, I mean, I was trained in a form of remote viewing as a psychic on the project that basically relies on eidetic images of distant events, both in space, in real time, and also non-local events in time-space. And what I keep on seeing, actually, is an appearance in the White House with President Obama regarding the fact that Mars is inhabited. I think what must happen is I must strike a deal with him to avoid any discussion of the fact that he had prior knowledge of his presidency, which I do have based on my sort of accidental meeting with him when we were college students in the summer of springtime of 1982, when he was in Los Angeles visiting his friends from Occidental College after he had spent a year at Columbia under the tutelage of Zbigniew Brzezinski, who had just been national security advisor. And you may remember from the interview that he basically revealed, or his friend revealed in front of him, that he knew he was destined to be president. But he didn't know, and his friend from South Africa didn't know, that I knew what they were talking about and would later be able to tell about it, because I had been a kid on the project where those technical, you know, intelligence gathering capabilities were, you know, developed. But just as on a psychic basis, I keep on seeing this White House announcement event with President Obama. And I'm going to challenge him to become the Abraham Lincoln of the light workers and of the 21st century. I'm going to be writing him a letter to that effect. And I'm going to say, Mr. President, if you will evince the courage to be the Lincoln of the light workers, I pledge that I will be the Frederick Douglass. And you may recall that when a young man asked Frederick Douglass what he should do to create a better society on Earth, Frederick Douglass replied, agitate, agitate, agitate. And so I have dedicated myself to agitation. Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass are in my small pantheon of historical heroes. One of the reasons I became a lawyer is because of the legacy of lawyers like Abraham Lincoln and Mohandas K. Gandhi. And one of the reasons I became an orator is because of the legacy of people like Frederick Douglass or an attorney like Clarence Darrow. You know, Justice Robert Jackson saw Clarence Darrow give a 9-hour closing argument in a murder trial one day, and he said that it was one of the peak experiences of his life. And so we've lost something in our civilization because of the narrow time horizon in the area of oratory. And this is something that I'm going to try to start developing more. In other words, longer format presentations where somebody speaks literally for hours like they used to on the Chautauqua circuit. And the abolitionists used to talk all afternoon and there'd be music and so forth. And this is a tradition. Mark Twain would lecture in a long format. So I want to reignite this tradition of long format oratory in the U.S. But the specific thing that I'm going to say to President Obama is, look, we are contemporaries. You were born on August 4th of 1961. And I came into this scenario 44 days later on September 18th of 1961. And we met as college students. And you told me you knew you were going to become president. And I had forgotten from childhood that it had also been revealed to me that I was going to grow up and become the discoverer of life on Mars. And so what are the chances that two individuals from the same generation, born literally a month apart, would have such an accidental meeting as college undergraduates? And I'm going to say, Mr. President, I think it's your cosmic responsibility to join me in this truth campaign and wed your call for change with my call for truth and validate your call for truth by acknowledging that you can't have change as an individual or as a society or indeed as a global civilization if change doesn't begin with truth. You can't change anything until you confront the truth of the situation. And if he adheres to the diktats of the intelligence community and doesn't embrace my truth campaign, I'm going to say, Mr. President, I'm afraid you're going to have a failed presidency in broad historical terms. So I beseech you to embrace my truth campaign and be the president who reveals these cosmic truths to the people of the world. And as I said earlier in this broadcast, if President Obama does that, he indeed will be the second planetary whistleblower. And I think that may be more impacting than simply winning a prize as he did today by winning the Nobel Peace Prize.
In whatever measure, whatever small way we can do to help you, you know that you have a house here in Veritas. I have one last question. And let me preface the question. The question from Rick is, what is your opinion on 2012, which you discussed a lot during our broadcast? But before you answer that question, you mentioned brackish water in 2013. I'm from the Caribbean, so I know algae very well. And those people listening in Australia know that too. It takes time for algae to develop. If it's 2013 and you saw algae at the Supreme Court, it means that whatever may be happening, if this is the place or parallel universe, but if this is the place, it perhaps means that this may happen earlier than 2012. What's your opinion on that and on 2012?
Oh. Data that I can furnish other people to allow them to learn more or less about 2012, and certainly to assuage their fears or to just simply provide them information about what may happen in 2012 is the following. And that is, during that time probe from ITT Defense, via chronovision that was so advanced, we were actually in protective garb. There's no question in my mind that on that discrete timeline, the U.S. Capitol was under 100 feet of water and had been for a long enough period of time for the water, if it was seawater, to turn brackish. Now, when I spoke with Robert Felix, the Ice Age expert, he said that prior to the ice ages, when the global climate has gone chaotic and you have a situation where global temperatures reach a new high plateau of high temperatures, you have a melt of the ice caps that inundates the oceans with fresh water, and there's a recharging of all the coastal estuaries with fresh water. So it may explain the brackish water, which doesn't form in the ocean but forms in freshwater lakes and estuaries, is a recharging of the Potomac from excess freshwater in the Atlantic. We know if that happens, for example, if there's a melting of the North Pole and the South Pole, or if there's a melting of that glacier up, I believe it's in Norway, where it's in Greenland, I think, that a lot of fresh water, you know, just hundreds and hundreds of tons of water will rush into the Atlantic and inundate the eastern coast of the United States. It clearly was brackish water, and I was quite clear about my answers to the lieutenant commander in the Navy. After they took off my suit, they walked me up the hallway, and I actually sat on this chair next to his desk in this kind of book-lined office. And he questioned me for about, I'd say about an hour about what I saw. I can see what I saw to this day sitting here right with my laptop on my computer. The U.S. Supreme Court building was under a lot of water. The sensation we had when they brought us down to the target was like diving on an artifact under 100 feet of water in the ocean, like a Greek temple or something under the waves. But I must also stress that I know also to a personal certainty that at least via Chronovision, all the Chronovisor probes were to adjacent timelines. The Chronovisors were never to a single timeline. They were to multiverses. They were to similar timelines within a multiverse. But paradoxically, by the end of his life in 1990, when I was having those heart-to-heart discussions with my father in the late 80s, he shared information about me on the timeline that I've now lived, about how I was going to go to Cambridge, how I was going to graduate from law school and pass the bar, and how I was going to come back to the house and take care of my mother for several years while she had cancer, and that she was then going to die from cancer. So the paradox is that the total quantum access capability that was operational by the late 1980s that the U.S. government was in possession of was able to identify the discrete destiny, the discrete future timeline that a particular individual was destined to live. Courtney Hunt was describing this process of quote-unquote running a line on somebody, which I think was using a remote device to hit somebody with it, maybe a laser or something, and then somehow analyzing the refraction from that to determine exactly what vector a person was on relative to future timeline. But I also know that they shut down time travel to the past via Chronovision, because every time they sent the same kid or another kid to the same past event, like when they were sending me behind President Lincoln's box to see who shot him on April 14th of 1865, the scenario changed a little bit. One time via Chronovision, a guard would shoo me away and tell me to go back to the theater. Another time I got in and I actually saw Abraham Lincoln sitting there, like I was unable to see him when he was giving the Gettysburg Address. So I want to urge everybody to think of 2012, the 2012 that we're going to experience on this timeline, of an era of planetary, sort of a jump-off point for planetary cultural renaissance, a catalyst year rather than a year of catastrophe, because that's what I think it's going to be. And the reason I think that it's going to be that is because as I'm rolling out this information 3 years in advance, I'm getting help. I'm getting help from people like you, Mel, and your listeners. And it's accelerating. It's accelerating to the point that I've only gotten about 4 or 5 hours of sleep for almost a night for almost a year. Okay? So this situation is, this phenomenon is accelerating, and I think we're going to accelerate on the positive vector and live a 2012 that will be the jump-off point for a better human future. And I think we should focus on that, because I think by focusing on it, we're going to increase the likelihood that we will experience such a 2012.
You have no idea how thankful I am that you took more time of your busy schedule to be with us here. Once again, we exceeded this half an hour. Let me just open the chat so people can say good. Anybody who wants to say goodbye with their own voices. Andy, thank you so much. And whatever we can do to propel you even more, and just say it. Just let us know and we'll be there for you. So can you hear me? You're saying no. Can you hear me? Over.
Well, you know, thanks for giving me this platform. I mean, this is going somewhere, and I'm not going to relent. And like I said, I'm getting help from my fellow human beings, and I do believe I'm operating under protection. You know, I'm being prudent about my physical safety, but I'm going to move forward. And there are going to be more events this year where there's going to be a wider distribution of this information. And, you know, this train is bound for glory, man, because I'm not going to give up and I'm not going to give in. And this story is going to be told so that everybody on the planet knows that we can use the 21st century to create an advanced civilization on Earth where we take care of everybody and disadvantage nobody. That either we all prosper and we take care of everybody, or nobody is going to survive. And we're going to achieve that through doing things like implementing teleportation and also using high technology to create an advanced quality of life and state of existence on this planet, and also, you know, respect our highest ideals and take a peaceful, sustainable human society into the cosmos, for example, in the way that we engage the planet Mars. And I would also urge your listeners to keep abreast of the work that Alfred Weber is going to be leading in terms of the development of that Mars protectorate under the UN. and the Mars Treaty, because it's all related. We're at a jump-off point here, and I just feel that I'm honored and privileged to be part of it and helping to lead it. But many people are going to be jumping in and participating in it, because ultimately it's going to be the expression of the whole human race and just not one lawyer from Washington State who had the privilege of being involved in time travel activities back in the early 70s. It's going to involve everybody, and it's going to be very exciting, and I think we're going to make it.
Andy, and we'll definitely be in touch. You're a friend of this show, and I wish you safe. Be safe, be well, and let's keep in touch.
Melon, as Rosie Isis says, I wish love and light to all of your listeners, and I hope that they have a great weekend. So I'm signing off now and saying goodbye to everybody. So God bless you all, and let's do it. Let's create a sustainable planetary civilization here on Earth, because in the final analysis, we deserve it.
Friend, take good care. Bye for now. Microphone. By the way, thank you to those of you who are signing off right now. I appreciate you being here. I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. Over. Those who are recording, can you just identify yourself? I mean, we need to get audio of this chat, guys. This is it was better than the show. Would you agree?
All of it's better. All of it's good. This was awesome.
Great. And I think that Andy's one of the most underrated people out there right now, I have to say. Parts. I hope you recorded with some good quality, because you know I'm very perfectionist when it comes to that. And I don't know what I'm going to do with this. I think I may combine the Dr. Stephen Greer show with this chat, because he's only 1 hour. Right, Malcolm? I mean, when I heard him for the first time, I said to myself, "What in the world? This guy is not on Coast to Coast. This guy is not on Coast to Coast AM. Can you believe that?" Over. The unbelievable. And this is part of history, folks. This chat is going to be history, I'm telling you. So please, those of you who recorded it, let me put my email here. There, and make sure that you save it before you do anything with it. And email it to me, and we'll put it together. And it's going to be part two of the Andrew Bashago show. Andy has a Discovery of Mars group on Facebook that's gaining a lot of momentum. It's pretty late here. It's pretty late from some of in Europe. Well, actually, you're starting your day where you are. Let's see. My Sydney subjects are released. Yep. Anyway, please email them to me. Well, Lauren, that would be a great idea to transcribe this chat eventually. And you're my first contact person when it comes to that. Any other questions for me before I bid you farewell, folks? Yes, John, please. The full chat text will be great. That way we can post it in the member section. So you have it all completely, John, 100%?
I have it completely.
Zeros Isis, that's right, sorry. Thank you for being part of the chat. All right. Thank you very much, guys. I'll be waiting for those audio clips when I wake up in the morning, and we'll do something with it. Again, this is going to be a historic chat, and as you can see, we're going to do it again with other guests in the future. Take care, all. Have a nice day, nice evening, wherever you are.